You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Suyapa Portillo Vieda, who is an associate professor of Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina, Transnational Studies at Pitzer College. She recently published an article in Counterpunch. You should go read it. It's called "An Illegitimate U.S.-Backed Regime is Fueling the Honduran Refugee Crisis." Suyapa, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So what are people from Honduras and elsewhere fleeing?
Yeah, well, basically, there's a lot of reasons for what's happening right now. Clearly, in 2009, there was a coup d'etat which ousted a democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya Rosales, and brought into power this very conservative sort of regime with the Nationalist Party. There's been a couple of leaders of that come from the Nationalist Party. And, you know, this is a militaristic party. The most recent leader who illegally reelected himself, interestingly enough, Juan Orlando Hernández, instituted the military police, a lot of funding going into security / military. These are conservative people who are not interested in developing more jobs or improving, benefiting poverty or investing in healthcare, investing in public services. The other thing that's happening in Honduras, and I think that's something that's been happening throughout Central America and throughout the region, is that after the civil wars or the Revolutionary Wars in Central America ended in 1992 and 1996 in Guatemala and in Salvador in 96, these countries were plunged into neoliberal economy, into the global economy, without a process of reconstruction, right? So you went from extreme civil war, which debilitated the economic structure in the country, into sort of free trade zones, maquiladora industries, which many of those presidents consider development, you know? So you have maquiladora hire women from ages 15 to 40, and after 38 or 40 years of age, they throw them out because they're not fast enough, because, you know, they don't want to pay retirement or benefits. They work outside of minimum wage laws. And so it's interesting when these conservative presidents call maquiladoras and this kind of industry development, because it isn't, right? So to me, it's not surprising that women and children are fleeing Honduras, because, you know, you have people that haven't been able to work for 3 to 5 years. They haven't been able to find jobs. And many of them are women who are spewed out from this maquiladora industry. There's also, the entire country, 60.9% of the population is living in poverty. That means that they earn less than minimum wage or less than what you would need to pay for your basic consumption.
The country of Honduras we're talking about.
The country of Honduras, correct. 70% of countryside homes or rural homes live in poverty, and 61% of those 70% are in extreme poverty. So the other migration you're seeing is farm workers or people that would have normally migrated to the margin of the cities, right, and then thought of migrating internationally, coming directly to international migration because they just don't have enough food. So food is an issue, right? But the other question is that when you have a political mayhem as you've had in Honduras since 2009, and the U.S. has supported this illegitimate president and all the others that came before from 2009 on, because they're afraid of letting a populist or letting what they consider to be a socialist in power, what happens is that there isn't any attention to the people, right? So people are protesting that their vote wasn't listened to in November 2017. They voted for the opposition party, and There were a ton of irregularities, and basically this party was able to take the presidency illegally. And you know, basically, like, the entire community of the entire communities that are protesting are working class communities, our cities, our neighborhoods, our countryside areas that are protecting their environment, right, are protesting against this president. The Nationalist Party, which took over after the coup d'etat, has given over 900 concessions of land to external banks and developers and even internal developers. You know, it's extreme. And basically, the entire country is for sale. What happens with these extractive industries, for example, non-precious metals like copper or lead, hydroelectric plants, ecotourism ventures, is that they're displacing indigenous or Afro-indigenous communities from the countryside, and they have nowhere else to go, right? And so if they protest, which is their right to protest because they may not have been consulted by the government before granting this land, they have a right to protest because they have a right to be consulted on what happens in the indigenous land or Afro-indigenous land, then the government kind of comes down really hard, arrests people, shoots into crowds with, you know, utilizes the military police and the military to shoot into crowds and put people in danger. So in reality, you know, the situation is complex because, you know, you can't protest and you can't contribute to making the society a better place for their children, you know, to live in, right? At this point, they're just fighting for basic survival because you will get shot at. I was in Honduras on a Fulbright this earlier this year from January to just August. And I went to document some of these things with the human rights workers. And, you know, some of the protesters were peaceful and they were shot at with real bullets. It was really shocking to me, right, to see that happen. So, you know, it's a place that's incredibly polarized politically. People don't know. They've exhausted all the different ways to change their society. They have peacefully protested. They have worked on, you know, building a new political party. People have let the president know that they didn't want him to be president by voting, you know,
yeah,
twice, 2013, 2014. And they just don't know what to do. So if there's no food and there's no way to improve their society, if there's no way to protect the environment they live in, so that they can continue to subsist from it, people are going to migrate. And, you know, it's desperate. I spent some time in the southern part of the country. The melon growers, right? So there's a lot of honeydew melon that's being produced in southern Honduras. These are some of the poorest regions of the country. It was even being at the meeting where people were talking about the conditions when I was interviewing them, it was obvious to me that people were malnourished, you know, that they lacked so much. And we're not just talking about the markers of, like, Western modernity, right? Electricity and potable water, things like that. We're talking about basic food, sustenance, you know?
Yes.
We're talking about a living wage, not any wage, but a living wage that respects minimum wage hours. We're talking about not being sprayed with, you know, contaminants, right, or pesticides when they're working. You know, people in Honduras are really hard up at this point. And so if the government is going to be this heavy hand that will get in the way of progress or get in the way of democracy, they're going to walk and they're going to go figure out how they can feed their family. So I think that there's all these different things happening at the same time and colluding with each other, right?
Yes.
Bad government, bad structures of government, the U.S. sort of heavy hand and reach into Honduran society for over 100 years, right, at this point, you know? And you also have sort of this political dynamic of the opposition, right? So all these things are happening, and I think that that's generated interest. Now, the caravan thing, I mean, you know, the caravan's about safety. People are going to migrate. You know, no matter how much money USAID puts into programs telling people not to migrate, people will migrate because they see the desperation in their families and their children in their community spaces. So they will have to migrate. And you know what? It's their right to migrate. It's a human right to migrate, and it's an individual decision for everybody. These are people that are not dumb. These are people that have thought through what their options are, and this is it. This is all they have.
Indeed.
They're going to migrate. But the caravan option is a better option because it means they're not going to be, women are not going to be raped by gang members in Mexico. They're not going to be extorted or robbed or killed. You know, there's been two massacres in Mexico since 2012. Right, of Honduran specifically in the northern part of Mexico, right? So this just guarantees their safety. Even if they are sleeping on the floor, even if, you know, they don't have enough food, at least they're all together and they will be safer than the stories that we've heard from other groups of migrants who have traveled by themselves.
Let me remind people that we're speaking with Suyapa Portillo-Vieda, whose article in Counterpunch is called "An Illegitimate U.S.-Backed Regime is Fueling the Honduran Refugee Crisis." Suyapa, in that article, on top of all of the violence and poverty and conditions you've described, you also describe certain groups of people, specifically women and gay and lesbian and transgender people, being targeted with murder in Honduras. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So Honduras is one of the most violent countries to be a woman, to be a transgender person, to be a gay person, to be a journalist, actually, you know, to be an attorney or a human rights lawyer, and to be a human rights worker and environmentalist, all in this one country of 9 million people. If you think about how small that is, right, and the reach that this poor government has over people. So transgender folk particularly and LGBT folks are facing dire situations, right? They're, on the one hand, not respected in the society. It's hard for them to get jobs as it is, right? If they don't have jobs, they're not welcomed into the formal economy. So they have to work in the informal economy. By working in the informal economy, it puts them in danger of being harassed by the national police, the military police, and gang members, right, who force them to actually sell or consume drugs, right? So either way, they're targeted on both sides. They feel trapped. They feel trapped because their rights, they don't have rights. And so of 200 murders since 2009, I think only two have been prosecuted. And if you look at the figures for the death of, I mean, over 600 women are killed in Honduras a year. 600 women who are, you know, it could be like domestic partner violence. It could be violence in the streets. You know, there's all these different dynamics that occur. But again, these are uninvestigated cases. You know, I think a couple of weeks ago, Casa Alianza released a report where this year alone, 50 children were killed. 50 kids from 15 to 25, let's say, are killed a month in Honduras, right? So these are the kinds of numbers that most of the media is not getting. Everybody talks about gangs and gangs this and gangs that. Yes, gangs are an issue, but let's remember that gangs are like the peddlers compared to the narco-traffickers. Gangs are not in power. You know, they don't have military power. They don't have, you know, military police, you know, and that gangs and narco-traffickers thrive in weak governments that are corrupt. And so corruption is really sort of, yes, it's at the bottom of what's going on, but it's not just corruption, right? It's this political, ideological model that the U.S. is imposing in Latin America, afraid of socialism, right? Afraid of Venezuela, afraid of what could happen in Latin America. And really, it's absurd if you look at, we're in the 21st century, right? And look at the failures, right, of the U.S., of this U.S. model in Latin America and all over the world. So I think that we really need to talk to the U.S. public, talk to the American public about the realities here. People just want to have an opportunity to have their cases heard in a courtroom without having to sit in jail for 2 or 3 years until their cases are heard. They want an opportunity to participate in their local civil political government. These are things that they don't get to do right now with this government, right? So the government says that they're holding a dialogue, right, to discuss what happened in the elections in November 2017. But nobody trusts them. Nobody trusts the police. So if something happens to you, you wouldn't go to the police. If, you know, if you get robbed at gunpoint, if someone came into your house, you wouldn't go into the police, because oftentimes the police is linked to these gang members and, or these low-level traffickers. So, you know, I think that one of the biggest issues here has been sort of the U.S. reach and imposing Juan Orlando Hernández on the people of Honduras, when the people chose through a democratic free vote that they did not want him. So that's one issue, right? And also, you know, addressing the coup d'etat and what happened there. A lot of these Central American countries after war went into a neoliberal economic model without reconstruction. If you think about the devastation of 250,000 murdered people in Guatemala, 80,000 murdered people, so many disappeared by the thousands, 2,000 people were disappeared in Honduras, students in Nicaragua. And there hasn't been a process of reconstruction. If you think about the U.S. Civil War and the war we had here in the U.S., you know, we had a process of reconstruction. And I feel like that led this country to emerge, right, into a different nation. And I feel like that's the kind of space Central America needs, right? They need a process of reconstruction that doesn't involve sort of random free capital extractive industries and sort of the U.S. reach on there. Like, people need to redefine and refound their nation. And that's what the process of the resistance is in Honduras right now. They're refounding what it means 200 years after independence, you know, because we're coming up in 2021 to 200 years of independence from Spain. What does it mean? And who, you know, what is their identity? Who are they? Are they going to be this typical nations that are constantly convulsing because of U.S. aid, or will people have an opportunity to lead themselves and emerge, right, as a nation as they wish to see themselves? So I think that those are the tensions that you're seeing in Honduras right now, and that, you know, is contributing in large part to people migrating, right? The country itself is just not making it. I mean, yeah. I have some figures here, you know, the basic food basket costs a month $325 for a household of five, but a household of five altogether makes about $519. So really that leaves less than $200 for people to, you know, spend in education and health care, in, you know, advancing their desires and buying a house and things like that. So, you know, do the math, right? It just doesn't make sense that this is tenable, you know, that this is going to be sustainable. And so people, in some ways, that's why they have to migrate.
But the Pentagon only has $23 trillion it can't account for, so it's not as if there's just lots of money floating around or anything that could be put to use. In the sense that Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and Barack Obama as President supported the coup government, it seems as if Donald Trump is accidentally saying something correct for once without really meaning it when he blames Democrats for this migration. At least there's part of the responsibility to be laid there, correct?
Well, the one thing to remember is that we've had child migration for a while, you know, from Latin America. If you look at Cuba in the 60s, El Salvador in the 80s, you know, there's been child migration. I think what's different now, you know, is that, people are migrating in a caravan for safety. They're right. Not a mob. They're not here to take over the United States. It's for safety.
To survive
that's,
Mexico.
That's survival, right? This is survival tactic. And two, just to remember, too, that you know, people have a right to cross borders. You know, it's their life, it's their prerogative. And, you know, they will, I think people are aware that they're going to confront what they're going to confront. It's what I'm, you know, I think that they're aware that's how severe the situation is. Now, did Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, blunder in Central America? Yes, right? They didn't behave as you would have thought, you know, progressives would be. You know, we were very excited about Barack Obama. We thought he was going to be a different kind of leader for Latin America. We didn't expect them to be.
Please don't include. Please don't include me in that. They certainly behaved the way I expected them to behave, and I oppose it and I condemn it. And their successors are behaving just as badly. But do you think that Donald Trump or any of his chorus in Congress or the media actually believe the things they say, that there's something illegal about fleeing and trying to find shelter as a refugee, that there are Middle Eastern Muslim armed invaders here, that this is some sort of a threat to the United States? Do they believe that?
I think, on the one hand, they're so misinformed. I wouldn't be surprised if they believe it. They are misinformed and in complete ignorance about A, how migration functions, what the demographic looks like, and you know, how this is all working out. I mean, I feel like they really lack some expertise in that, and they're showing it. But this is not the only issue that they lack expertise on, as you know, right? So their ignorance here is expected from this president. I also feel like he's throwing, he's throwing fire and to see what he gets, right? To appease to his constituents and things like that. It's not true that we are being bombarded at the border, actually, because we have the U.S. has actually deported people, but the numbers have gone down. It's Mexico who's doing the dirty work for the U.S. The U.S. pays Mexico, and Mexico has deported more Central Americans now than the U.S. has. So they don't even make it to the border. The other thing, too, is that many of the cases that come through the system here, they've been reduced. Since 2014, you've seen a reduction in the cases that have been heard or the people that have been gone through asylum hearings. You know, it's incredibly hard. In fact, because of Sessions' last orders, attorneys require experts now to even bring their cases for a master hearing or even to prepare their clients for the next step, right? So it's incredibly hard in the U.S. to get asylum now with these latest sort of harsh policies from the Trump administration. So it's not true. It's not true that we're, bombarded. Mexico, however, has been receiving a lot of immigrants, and they've tried a couple of things. You know, in some cases, they've given humanitarian visas. In other cases, they've offered people opportunities to stay if their cases are heard. In other cases, they're just supporting a lot of people. And because it's closer to Central America, it's just a bus ride away. And that's what's been happening. So the deportations from Mexico have increased, and people don't make it to the border. So I just think he's misinformed about migration in general, but also creating hysteria and among people about this issue when in reality we need to be looking at these people as human beings who deserve to be seen as refugees. They deserve their cases to be heard in a court of law. They deserve to tell their story. And I feel like the Mexican people and the Guatemalan people are responding in humanitarian ways, but their governments aren't. So there's always been a disconnect there, with bad governments and their people. So I'm excited to see what the new president, José López Obrador in Mexico, is going to do. And we're eagerly awaiting that December 1st deadline to see what his response is going to be to this. I mean, I've heard that he's going to provide work visas. I heard that he's going to provide humanitarian visas, but there's nothing concrete yet from Mexico.
What can he do to prevent the U.S. wall? And is there any moral, legal, practical justification for such a wall?
There isn't. There really isn't. And I feel like Trump imposing that on Guatemala, Mexico, because that's the wall that I think he's really silently working on. I know he's talking a lot publicly about the U.S.-Mexico wall, but I think he knows he wants to muscle, Mexico and Guatemala into building this wall. I think that would be devastating, Historically, these Latin American nations have had open borders. So, for instance, Central Americans can travel between each Central American country was just their ID, for instance, right? The way we used to do it with Mexico or Canada, they don't need a passport. That's where people are able to cross, you know?
Yeah.
That has been something that's been, you know, these are nations that at one time dreamed of being a federation, right? And so to impose these sort of strict rules on these nations is going to diplomatically damage relations between those nations and the people of those nations. And historically, it's just, it's never been necessary, and it's never been something that, you know, has been considered, it would be considered something that's unbrotherly, if you will, you know. So the fact that, that he's really muscling Guatemala and Mexico to, you know, kind of cheer gas people to keep them, you know, from crossing, all those things would harm diplomatic relations, I think, between the nations. And it would create even more tensions, you know, that in the region. So I don't think that's the answer. I really think we need to look at our refugee law and modernizing some of these laws, figuring out how they can work, you know, how can we utilize certain aspects of them at certain moments, you know, and provide, you know, one is renew TPS, right? Why are we canceling TPS? Well, effectively, people are coming from a war-torn region, you know, because the conditions that Honduras is reflecting right now are conditions of an act of war.
Right.
You know, 600 women a year, that's extreme, you know, for 10 million, a country of 10 million people. So, less than 10 million people. So, I think that that's kind of what I would hope that Mexico, Guatemala, and the U.S. would adhere to international law on refugee status and provide shelter for people, even if it's through temporary protected status or other systems. So clearly, we really need to have temporary protected status active, and we need to really not be deporting people as he's promising, right? So I feel like his presidency is incongruent. It doesn't make sense. He doesn't understand diplomacy. Clearly, he doesn't understand how countries function. You know?
Just about 1 minute left. What can people listening to this program in the United States in particular do in terms of taking demands to the government or otherwise to help?
Well, I think emailing your representative is always important, keeping a relationship open with your representative about all of these issues that affect you or that you feel concerned about, particularly Honduras. Representative Norma Torres, for instance, here in this region of California, you know, is working on anti-corruption but doesn't engage with human rights. So encouraging her to please engage on human rights issues in Honduras. So that's always good. The other thing is check in with your immigrant rights organization in your city to see how you can assist, you know, whether you can assist the caravan people or whether you can assist the immigrant rights group work that is happening locally in your region, right? So depending where you are, if you're in LA, check in with Carecen or the TPS Alliance or the National Day Labor Network, for instance, and make sure that, you know, you're lending a hand. If you don't have time to lend a hand, you can donate money.
Good advice. We will have to leave it there. Suyapa Portillo Villegas, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there's a reason the man who murdered 11 Jewish people in a Pittsburgh synagogue also ranted online about some thousands of mostly women and children making their way from Honduras to the U.S.-Mexico border to seek asylum. It's the same reason torch-wielding marchers chanting, "Jews will not replace us," in Charlottesville in 2015 stopped to beat up a black man. White supremacists connect Jewish people and black people and immigrants and LGBTQ people and uppity women in a worldview about an existential threat to themselves as white Christian Americans. Other people also have a worldview that connects Jews, black and brown people, immigrants, and other disadvantaged communities, connects them in coalitions that recognize their shared vulnerabilities and work together for social and economic justice. We'll talk about the relationship between anti-Semitism and white supremacy, our resistance, and how media could be part of the solution with Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, Audrey Sassone. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The New York Times Magazine looked at Kensington, a neighborhood in northeast Philadelphia, for an October 10th feature. As Jordan Holy Cross noted for Fair.org, they didn't see a diverse and resilient community fighting tirelessly against adversity, but instead a chance to take readers on a sensational 6,000-word tour of trauma, complete with cringeworthy language and compassionless photographs. Reporter Jennifer Percy began by painting a dismal and menacing backdrop. Quote, "The streetlights were broken or dim, and the alleyways were dark. Most of the blocks were lined with two-story row houses, abandoned factories, and vacant lots. Kensington Avenue, the neighborhood's main drag, was a congested mess of Chinese takeouts, pawn shops, check-cashing joints, and Irish pubs," close quote. How many urban neighborhoods have brightly lit alleys? Was there any other way to describe a mix of businesses catering to working-class customers associated with diverse ethnicities other than a congested mess? This framing continued throughout the feature. At one point, Holy Cross writes, Percy described the Kensington underpass as dark, like the opening to a rat hole. As if all underpasses aren't dark. Anyone who gets off the train in Kensington is reduced to a buyer, as in, quote, "the train doors opened and buyers spilled onto the walkway," close quote. Because Percy can't imagine why anyone would go to Kensington other than to buy drugs. The Times doesn't shy away from stigmatizing people who do use drugs. Percy writes artlessly of one individual, quote, "his eyes looked as if someone had scooped them out and filled them with mud," close quote. The piece reserved the word residents for those who lawfully live in Kensington's houses and apartments. Anyone else, regardless of how long they've lived in Kensington, was just another homeless addict. Holy Cross points to the current AP style guide, which urges reporters to use person-first language when covering the drug issue, replacing the noun addict with phrasing like "he was addicted" or "people with heroin addiction" or "he used drugs." But in every possible instance, the Times describes these people as addicts or users. Alex Sheriffs, a Philadelphia resident who's witnessed the effects of stigmatizing language through her work, reached out to the paper about their language use, asking in a tweet if they would consider person-first language to talk about addiction. Philip Corbett, the Times Associate Managing Editor for Standards, responded, quote, "We do recognize the sensitivity of this topic and understand the arguments about words like addict and alcoholic. At the same time, as with many issues of language and terminology, we try to weigh the pros and cons of terminology favored by experts against the widely used and accepted layperson's language. At this point, addict remains widely used among ordinary readers, and even some people who have addictions continue to use the term. On the other hand, I think that, for now at least, a person with a heroin addiction, and similar phrases, would strike many readers as unfamiliar and strained. Close quote. It's not clear why the Times thinks readers would be puzzled by a phrase like a person with a heroin addiction, especially knowing that research shows that describing people solely as addicts generates implicit and explicit bias against them, while person-first language helps eliminate it. Brooke Feldman, a community activist who was interviewed for and quoted in the Times article, told Holy Cross she was surprised and upset after reading the piece. She said her interview with Percy included a productive conversation about not sensationalizing the situation in Kensington, but that the final product did just that. Feldman was also disappointed that the many practical solutions being built by Kensington's grassroots organizations were absent. After reading the piece, one would be forgiven for assuming that city officials had taken the lead in providing resources for Kensington's struggling populations. Government officials are described as being the people on the ground trying to get people into treatment or provide access to services. The Times completely ignored the many non-governmental organizations that have been doing this work every day for years, well before the city declared Kensington a disaster area. For instance, the group Prevention Point was mentioned once, described simply as a nonprofit on Kensington Avenue that exchanged dirty needles for clean ones. Prevention Point has also helped get hundreds of people into treatment in the past year, Holy Cross writes, runs a homeless shelter, provides case management and help with legal services, teaches individuals and groups how to administer Narcan, and gives those who use drugs a safe place to exist. It's been instrumental in helping to guide the city's efforts and making sure that people stay alive long enough to get treatment. The Times framing propped up the city's official narrative while ignoring the hard work of advocates and of residents. Feldman is concerned that the Times piece will only add to the stigma that much of corporate media has already generated. Sensational stories cause harm and add to stigma, which is the number one barrier to people opening up and being willing to receive services, she said. For those most impacted, dehumanizing reporting can be deadly. Jair Bolsonaro, the new president of Brazil, has promised to unleash a wave of violence on the working class, minorities, and the left. An army officer during Brazil's fascist military dictatorship, about which he maintains that its only error was not killing enough people, Bolsonaro told his supporters to shoot every Workers' Party supporter in Acre State in September. As Alan McLeod notes for Fair.org, at a presidential rally, Bolsonaro declared, quote, "These red outlaws will be banished from our homeland. It will be a cleanup the likes of which has never been seen in Brazilian history. Either they go overseas or they go to jail." Close quote. Bolsonaro has declared himself in favor of torture and dictatorship and carte blanche for police killing. He told a Congress member he wouldn't rape her because she didn't deserve it, and said that gay children should be beaten. During the 2016 impeachment of Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff, who was tortured by the dictatorship, Bolsonaro dedicated his impeachment vote to the colonel who tortured her. Bolsonaro's economic plans include cuts to pensions, a fire sale of state assets, and opening up the country's vast natural resources for foreign exploitation. The view of U.S. financial markets and their uncritical mouthpiece, the financial press, McLeod reports, has been clear. Before the election, the Financial Times and CNBC both reported that the markets were cheering Bolsonaro's lead in the presidential race, with a follow-up Financial Times piece noting weapons companies surging stocks under his emergence as the frontrunner, a trend mirrored by stocks more generally as his performance, quote, heartened investors, close quote. Brazil's markets have surged on hope of Bolsonaro victory. Can he deliver? Ran a New York Times headline, by which it meant deliver on promises to gut Social Security. The CBC explored the new world of possibilities for profits for Canadian corporations in agriculture, extractive sectors, and finance, as Bolsonaro promises to slash environmental regulations and virtually all market restrictions. It could be a good time to be a mining investor in Brazil, the CBC reported. The Wall Street Journal went the furthest. Its editorial board endorsed Bolsonaro as a credible reformer, describing him as an antidote to the greed of opponent Fernando Haddad's Workers' Party. It also made the claim that the election was, quote, transparent, competitive, and fair, close quote. Truly remarkable, considering Bolsonaro is widely accused of illegally employing foreign companies to create a massive fake news industry via WhatsApp, and that former leftist president Lula da Silva, by far the most popular candidate, had been jailed on questionable charges and barred from running. So what can you say? Faced with the choice of center-left reformers who might tax business slightly more and outright fascists, the financial press showed who they serve and who they are. They're not interested in the human cost of Bolsonaro's near-genocidal statements, the cost to the population if pensions are gutted and state assets sold off, the cost to the Amazon, a crucial carbon reserve that has to be maintained and strengthened if humanity has any chance of mitigating the catastrophe of climate change. These, we conclude, are mere externalities. When it comes to opportunities for profit, nothing else matters. Readers and viewers, take note. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. On October 5th, Fox host Maria Bartiromo asked Senator Chuck Grassley if he thought George Soros was behind public criticism of Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination, or as she put it, paying these people to get you and your colleagues in elevators or wherever they can get in your face. Grassley responded, quote, I have heard so many people believe that. I tend to believe it. I believe it fits in his attack mode and how he uses his billions and billions of resources. I think it promotes incivility in American society. Close quote. An hour later, Trump tweeted, the very rude elevator screamers are paid professionals only looking to make senators look bad. Don't fall for it. Also, look at all of the professionally made identical signs, paid for by Soros and others. Neither Bartiromo, nor Grassley, nor Trump noted that George Soros is Jewish. They don't need to. References to a billionaire secretly pulling the strings of disruptive, unpatriotic activists draw on decades, even centuries, of anti-Semitic ideas, ideas that can fuel violence, as painfully shown by the October 27th killing of 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. That the horror of Jews being killed because they were Jews came shortly after two black people were killed because they were black in a Kentucky grocery store seemed to encourage some to think about the relationship between anti-Semitism and the white supremacy rearing its head in Trump-era public life. Others have been seeing those connections and acting on them for many years now. We're joined now in studio by Audrey Sasson, Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. Welcome to Counterspin, Audrey Sasson.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the mythology around philanthropist George Soros, an actual complex human being, deserving of scrutiny like any other powerful person. It's hard to overstate how large Soros looms in the minds of the right and far right. He was also sent a pipe bomb, along with other frequent Trump targets. Tell us about the Soros myth and how it fits with what we know about how anti-Semitism works.
I want to actually lift up, not only was he sent one of the bombs, he was sent the first bomb that went out to the political opponents. And that I think is significant. At JFRED, we have for a long time, you know, of course, been critical of the accumulation of capital and wealth and how that is creating an unequal society. And we're very invested in trying to push back against that. But the case of Soros House is troubling and obviously dangerous for a lot of reasons. George Soros is Jewish. He is an immigrant, and he is the face, really, of what is considered the typical conspiracy theory about Jewish power, Jewish globalism, Jewish sort of puppet mastery over social movements. And this is not new. This goes back centuries, as you mentioned. And in Trump's campaign, it also came up early on. So I don't know if you remember this, but Trump's final campaign ad that he did right before the election included an image of Soros, talked about the elite globalists who are controlling everything. And this idea of Jews controlling the economy, controlling popular disruption and unrest basically does two things. It delegitimizes the message and it delegitimizes the messenger. And so when there are popular movements that are united, that are multiracial, that are across gender, across class, that these movements get interrupted. And the idea here is that the people who are organizing don't have the chops to do it on their own. They don't have the agency to do it on their own. Oftentimes black and brown folks who are basically told, or in the case of Kavanaugh, women, that they don't have the agency, so that they can't really do this, but also that it is in the interest of these global elites to control what's going on. And so it creates a very convenient target and scapegoat.
It's saying that these people, all of these people, could only be pawns because they couldn't possibly have these goals and the agency to act on them on their own if
That's
they
right.
weren't being puppet mastered. Well, the idea that Jews corrupt the true citizens of a nation, you know, that also explains why Tree of Life was targeted not just for their religion, but for their relationship with the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
Mm-hmm.
That's why a guest on Fox Business accused Soros of masterminding the group of Central Americans struggling to seek asylum to the U.S. It has to do with bringing other people in, right?
Mm-hmm. It's the undesirables, exactly. So it is no coincidence that there was a direct link there made by the shooter between the synagogue and Hayes. The president, or 45, has been talking about the caravan and the migrants in ways that would have evoked that. And so it was no surprise to see that there was a link being made there. And so I think what it does is it calls on us to actually double down on the fact that we are united and we won't be divided. And what these attempts are really attempts to divide our movements, and we have to remain vigilant against that.
I wanted to just underscore one thing that former executive director of J. Fred Stubb Kent wrote recently, that it isn't just anti-Semitism on its own, but anti-Semitism deployed against the left that gives the lie about Soros its cultural power. We can connect, you know, the Koch brothers are funding this group and that group, and it doesn't have the same impact because the Soros story feeds on all these other
lies. And we've seen it in the history of the civil rights movement is another example where this was done, where I recently saw this totally amazing, I mean, it's in our book as well. We have a guide called Understanding Antisemitism that we invite people to check out. And it has an example of this leaflet that was out in the 50s, basically blaming the Jews for the civil rights movement. They are the puppet masters behind that, and that essentially the black community would not be rising up on its own without it. The reason that it's so important to connect the dots between white supremacy and anti-Semitism. And we're seeing more and more an understanding and acknowledgement of this, thanks to a lot of really good writing and analysis that's being circulated right now, is that if people are dealing with a bad economy, inequality on so many levels, racial and economic inequality, and they are looking for something to blame for that. We punch up against the Jews to punch down against the people of color and the immigrants and others, so that there's sort of this space created where white Christian nationalists can basically say, this is our home, this is our nation. You all, whether you're Jewish on one side of this and you're not white, no matter how white you may look, you're not white to us. You're the ones that are basically responsible for this uprising by people down below us, then that creates sort of an us and them, and it really paves the way towards the fascism that we see moving forward.
That's a great point. Well, of course, there's another side to the linkage, which is the positive of the links. And, you know, you almost sense some surprise on some of the media's part. You're like, would you believe the first folks who came out in solidarity with the Jews in Pittsburgh were Muslims, you know? But this sort of solidarity among and across communities that face discrimination is itself not new and has its own long history.
Absolutely. It has been incredibly powerful to be able to sort of see that manifest and materialize, because we know J. Frege has been in relationship with a lot of these groups just here for the last three decades and across history, like you mentioned. We know that white Christian nationalism is coming after all of us. We see that at our vigil on Saturday night that J. Frege held to honor the memories of those fallen in Pittsburgh and in Kentucky, frankly, we had Muslim allies come out, and they were the ones who named the centrality of anti-Semitism to white supremacy. We didn't have to say that. They knew that they were coming arm in arm with us because we share, I don't want to say enemy, but it's really our shared purpose. Our shared purpose is to overcome that together, to build a world where we can all be sort of in our multiracial splendor together.
Well, let me ask you about media. There was a thing in the LA Times, and it said, I'll just read you this quote. Quote, activists said Trump's vilification of liberal philanthropist George Soros, whom he has accused of hiring people to protest conservative causes, has played into conspiracy theories about wealthy Jews, close quote. So we don't know from this if Soros has hired protesters. It's just something activists claim. You know, we don't know whether Trump's vilification of Soros actually plays into conspiracy theories. Not to mention that this quote is followed up with Trump supporters deny that he has stoked hate. I just sort of feel like this kind of reporting, activists claim there are conspiracy theories that target Jews. I think the time for that has passed.
Thank you for saying that. I couldn't agree more. There's a sort of both sides sort of thing going on here. The dangers and the stakes are so high. The threats are escalating. You know, we're in a proto-fascist moment. And for the media to not be able to name that, is it at best, it's just sort of a willful ignorance. And at worst, it's pushing an agenda that's really not paying attention to the fact that there's a context here for all of these dog whistles and all of these statements. When Trump says he's a nationalist and not a globalist, what is he saying? Like, what is he saying right there? He's doing two things. He has double duty right there. He's saying to his white Christian base that might not be neo-Nazis, he's saying to them, we're together. We can build our white Christian nation together. I'm with you. It's just we are the quote majority, according to him. And to the neo-Nazis out there, he's saying, I see you. I understand those Jews out there, they're the problem. They're the ones who are causing all of this trouble for us by riling up the masses. And that foments violence. And that's why we end up with the hate violence and the political violence. I don't even want to say hate. It's political violence. And it's political violence because it is targeted, has a political purpose. And that purpose is to push us even further into this us versus them white Christian nationalist state.
And there's no reason for media to allow any sort of deniability there. Well,
that's right.
Maybe in terms of signals, this might be more subtle. Washington Post White House bureau chief Philip Rucker tweeted, quote, remarkable protest scene in Squirrel Hill. Demonstrators are neither yelling nor chanting. They don't seem angry. Old and young, they are walking peacefully, singing softly, and letting their very presence and placards deliver their message, close quote. I am not denying that he was moved and that there is something powerful about quiet protest, but I can't help but get a vibe there that they aren't making noise like the black people, you know, that this is the correct way to protest,
right.
You know, just weep quietly in the street, you know. I really think we have to resist that policing of grief, for one thing. I'm not really trying to accuse him of anything. I just think that any sort of thing that seems to hold some of our movements against others that appears to contrast, you know, the Jewish resistance to the shooter in Pittsburgh. It's not like a Black Lives Matters march, you know, like I think we've got to push back against that.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, of course, J. Frege has been arm in arm with Black Lives Matter from the get go. And our membership is multiracial. And we see these things as connected. Just today, someone called up the office and said, I wanted to check in because I heard there was a vigil tonight that was going to be honoring the Pittsburgh victims at the same time as the Kentucky victims. And I think that's exactly what we need to be doing. This was a Jewish woman up on the Upper West Side who saw what was going on and connected the dots and was like, this is all of it. The Charleston and Tree of Life, these are connected. These are connected struggles. We are all in this together. So yeah, any attempt to divide us and any attempt to terrorize us into that isolation is something we have to resist. We have to be mindful of the threats. We have to be real about all of that, but we have to resist the attempts to divide our communities.
Well, I was going to ask you where you see hope, and I think you've just said it, really, with that increasing recognition. I meant also coming out of that Washington Post thing, I guess I really meant to just sort of say, what sorts of things would you like to see more or less of from mm-hmm. media? So you can connect those two things if you like, in your final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for the media to be a little bit more attentive to these sort of dog whistles and to put them in context and to not let politicians be able to skate on these things when someone says incivility, or there are certain terms that are clearly signaling an agenda that we shouldn't let them get away with. You know, there was a Wall Street Journal piece a while back when the tweets about Soros started coming out, and there was a response saying that we, you know, that it's anti-Semitic and that we weren't going to fall for it. Of course, Jay Fridge said, we're not falling for this. But there was a piece that really legitimized these things as, like you said, sort of like creating sort of what is the argument for or against calling Soros to task for funding these movements. And the part that I want to like just also lift up is that we live in a world where there are going to be people who fund our movements. And that is not the same thing as paying protesters. Obviously, we shouldn't have to explain that. But it was really strange because the article was just like, you know, they even had a table set up with markers at the Kavanaugh hearing. Like clearly someone is paying for this and they're going out of the way. And I want to just say from a personal perspective, so I know intellectually and theoretically and from an organizing perspective why all of that is totally messed up and we need to be vigilant and we need to be mindful and we need to not buy into it. And I was like, those women, the agency that it took to like go out there, the courage it took for people to go and speak their truth, their vulnerable truth, and how dare you? Like, how dare you take that away? To me, that was one of the most insidious things about it, that you would strip that agency away from people who are putting everything on the line in order to speak truth to power. Right. Same with Pittsburgh, with anywhere where our movements are stepping into the line of fire, stepping into the really scary moment that we're in. To take that away is just, how dare you? And we all need to be doing more of, I think we are doing it. I am seeing it. I think we need to double down on what we have been doing, which is building multiracial coalition, building multi-faith and multiracial coalition, understanding isolation is our enemy, and the only way through this is together. We are the majority. It's not just that we are against all of these bad things. We also are the majority that are for so much good. Like the ideas, the organizations and the people on the ground that are fighting for Medicare for all, that are fighting against increasing concentration of wealth and power, that are fighting against entrenched racism within policing. We have a vision of a future where we can actually all have shared prosperity and power. And shared prosperity and power is like the only thing that's really going to push back against anti-Semitism and is going to push back against white supremacy. Like those are the things that are going to get us there. I think that that is what we do share. And I think that we have to just leverage that and bring that to the front. I think we know what to do.
We've been speaking with Audrey Sasson, Executive Director of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. They're online at jfrege.org, and that's where you can find their resource, Understanding Antisemitism. Audrey Sasson, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. And the website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Two centuries ago, the world was fully renewable, but at the time, it was 1 billion peasants. So a 100% renewable world, I know at least one option. We will go through a contraction of the economy because we will go through a maximum in the use of fossil fuels, and renewables will compensate for a small fraction, but not for the whole.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have a special treat for you this week. The world premiere of an English-language in-depth radio interview with Jean-Marc Jancovici. Jean-Marc is well-known in Europe and beyond as a consultant in both energy and climate change. He is an author of several books, the latest being Sleep Quiet Until 2100 and Other Misunderstandings About Climate and Energy. Jean-Marc founded his company, Carbon 4, and an NGO called The Shift Project. Jancovici is also a member of ASPO France, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, or l'Association pour l'étude des pics pétroliers et gaziers. I'm Alex Smith. Let's do it. Did you know energy is free and peak oil is not so dead? That comes from a French expert in technology, energy, and climate, Jean-Marc Jancovici. Jean-Marc co-founded Carbon 4 Consultancy and The Shift Project. He advises, writes books, and lectures, mostly in French, but his ideas resonate with American writers like Richard Heinberg. From Paris, Jean-Marc Jancovici, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning or afternoon, I don't know.
It depends on where you are in the world. You seem to say we cannot continue to live with fossil energy, but we can't continue to live without it either. What do you mean?
Actually, when you look at what happened during the last two centuries, which, by the way, was most of American history, you realize that what people have done is that we shifted from energy converters that were mostly our bodies and domesticated animals and firewood and wind, that is renewable energies, to energy converters made of metal, that is engines. And these energy converters allowed to develop, actually they allowed to turn each of us into an Iron Man. And to multiply the amount of transformation that we can each perform by a factor, let's say 200 in the world, 1,000 in the U.S. or 2,000 in the U.S. So what energy did, actually, is that it gave the food to machines, new food, food that came below the ground when renewable energy comes from on the ground or above the ground, food that came below the ground to feed new slaves that don't think, that don't complain, that are perfectly moral, that are machines. And actually, industrial times is going from renewable energies to fossil fuels with a little extra, namely nuclear, but it's a small amount in the world. And that allowed to multiply by several hundreds the ability to produce something, that is to transform matter for each of us. That's basically what happened during the last two centuries. And wherever this happened, the society evolved like. Namely, when you look at the way the day-to-day life changed either in Europe or in the US or in USSR before Russia and then Russia again or in Japan or etc., there is a very simple rule, which is tell me how much energy you use and I will tell you the way you live. Because, again, energy is machines and machines, or energy is transforming, actually. It's in physics, it's what quantifies transformation energy. So there is something that happened during these historical times, something very specific, never happened before. It's the ability to increase by several hundred the physical flows that surround us. But this relies basically on fossil fuels. And fossil fuels, they are well named, they are fossils, or actually they are they come from fossils. Fossil fuels, namely oil, gas, and coal, are all remnants of ancient life. For coal, it's old ferns that lived 300 million years ago. And for oil and gas, it's basically algae and, and plankton, wherever it existed, that lived any time between 50 million years ago and 400 million years ago. This ancient life, that was marine life, part of it, well, actually all of it died. Part of it became sequestrated below the ground because of tectonics. Then it became, it got the heat, the inner heat from the earth, that kind of distillated that organic matter, and it turned it into oil and gas, some of it becoming trapped by reservoirs. This is, by essence, not renewable. Actually, it's renewable if you can wait 100 million years, what we don't do, but in the course of historical times, say a couple million years, it is not renewable. And there is a very simple math theorem that says that when you pick into a non-renewable stock, that is a stock that you cannot renew, it's given once and for all, the extraction from that stock is going to start at zero if you go far enough in the past, that's minus infinite. It's going to end at zero if you go far enough in the future, that's plus infinite. And in between the two, it's going to pass through an absolute maximum, that's the peak. And actually that theorem can be applied to anything which will never be renewed. So we can apply it to oil, we can apply it to gas, but we can also apply it to nickel, iron ore, copper, aluminium, just name it. So whatever comes from a mine has to go through a peak. The only questions are actually, will we trigger the peak or will we suffer from the peak? Is it something that we are going to decide and manage, or is it going something that we won't decide? It will just happen. Is it potentially far or not far from where we are? Is it at a very high level or not at a very high level from where we are? And actually, for a couple of resources, it's already behind us. So we might even ask ourselves the question, what are already the visible consequences of the fact that we are past or post-peak? So fossil fuels, now 80% of the energy supply, that is the fleet of machines that we use, are so efficient that they have replaced renewables, and we won't be able to replace them by renewables again, because that's, we have precisely done the opposite in the course of historical times. So the present standard of living just cannot be physically sustained without the help of fossil fuels for physical reasons. Again, they are incredibly dense, incredibly powerful, and that's why they have turned each of us into Iron Man. The economic counterpart, so to say, of that increased power is that the price of anything has gone down by tremendous amounts. If you take the U.S., for example, in 1930, food was 25% of what people earned. If you go to a supermarket today, the bill will be the bill for food. I mean, what you pay at the cashier will be 5% of what you earn. But within that amount, what you pay is mostly building the supermarket or now Amazon, whatever, building the packaging, paying the truck that brought the food, etc. And the food itself is going to be 2% of what you earn. And among that 2%, you eat 4 to 5 times more meat than 80 years ago. So the real price of food has been divided by several tens. And that actually can apply to anything that we buy today because we have put machines to work instead of people.
I watched a YouTube video of your English language lecture in Paris delivered in January 2018. It's called Can We Save Energy, Jobs, and Growth at the Same Time? You savaged the idea that we can live a similar life as today using only renewable energy, and that's odd to hear from a person who has helped advise governments on environmental policy. Why can't we have the good life with renewables?
Well, there is something in your question which is not true. I don't advise governments because governments are not advised. They respond to external pressures. The first external pressure they respond to is elections. Then there is permanent ongoing pressures which come from what we call lobbies. But lobbies actually can come from both sides. I mean, Environmental Progress is a lobby. Environmental Defense Fund is a lobby, as well as the Union of Chemists or whatever. So what governments do everywhere in democracies, it's not exactly true in other regimes, but in democracies, what they do is that they respond to external pressures. Right now, the president that you have is not doing anything else, or he's not doing anything different than what Obama did, only he's not responding to the same pressure, or he's not serving the same people. The reason why I say this, again, is for physical reasons. it's not possible to keep the same flows. So when you look at something that a productive activity, what is a productive activity? It's transforming resources into manufactured products, and that's true even for services. If you look at Netflix, for example, Netflix, to exist, needs cables, computers, electricity production. It needs trenches to bury the cables. It needs satellites that must be launched by rockets, etc. All this is material. I mean, all this is material. All this requires mines. All this requires fossil fuels. All this requires metal industries. All this requires chemistry. So all this is material. And actually, when you look at the footprint of a laptop, for example, producing a laptop is emitting half a ton of CO2 into the air. So the idea that today we have services that don't require material inputs is totally false. Actually, when you plot the fraction of services into employment versus energy consumption, you have something which is a positive correlation. Actually, the more energy you use per capita in a given country, and the higher the fraction of services into employment. So what we are witnessing today is a civilization in which we have terribly increased the physical flows, including in services, and that can be done only with fossil fuels. And again, what we have done in the course of the last two centuries is coming from renewables. Again, two centuries ago, the world was fully renewable, but at the time, it was 1 billion peasants. So 100% renewable world, I know at least one option to achieve it. It's to go back to 1 billion peasants with a life expectancy at birth that was something like 25 years or 30 years, let's say. But a 100% renewable world in a world with 7 billion people living like even a minimum wage worker of a Western country, that is just simply not possible. I mean, if you do the maths and look at the rule of three, you just can't figure a way to achieve this. Now, once I've said this, what is the practical conclusion? The practical conclusion is that it will decrease a way or another. And actually, if you look at Europe, Japan, and even to some extent the US, all these countries have gone through an absolute maximum of their energy supply in 2006. In my view, it's what triggered what we call the subprime crisis. The subprime crisis is actually triggered by an energy crisis, with a spike in oil prices in 2008, but it's not a matter of price, it's a matter of volume. So the volume of oil that came into these countries after 2006 decreased, and that triggered a contraction of the physical flows, that is, the economy, and that triggered an economic crisis. So anyway, we can put it whatever we want. We will go through a contraction of the economy because we will go through a maximum in the use of fossil fuels, and renewables will compensate for a small fraction, but not for the whole. Same thing for nuclear. I advocate for nuclear, and I think that in this context, calling non-nuclear is something that globally avoids risks and not globally creates risks. But it's not going to avoid the contraction of the system. It's going to soften it if we call on nuclear. So, and in my view, it's a good idea to soften the contraction.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with French expert in energy and climate change, Jean-Marc Jancovici. So you have talked about energy as a background cause of the 2007-2008 financial crisis, and elsewhere in your work, you've offered the energy supply as a solution for many other things, including, you say, Brexit is a direct consequence that the energy supply has begun to decrease in Europe. And that seems counterintuitive to me because there really isn't an energy crisis in the Middle East right now, but people are coming out of Syria and other countries. How do you explain that statement?
For the statement on Brexit, from 2006, the energy supply in Europe begins to decrease. When you look at the energy supply in Europe, so again, the food for the fleet of machines, but people that listen to us must understand that from now on, every time they come across the expression energy consumption, they must replace it by fleet of machines. That's what they must keep in mind. And then plenty of things become crystal clear. So from 2006, the energy supply in Europe begins to decrease. Why? Because 80% is fossil fuels. And these fossil fuels are the sum of coal, and coal is on decline regarding production in Europe since the early 80s. And it's not easy to import coal in massive quantities because the logistics of importing coal is a nightmare. You must have dedicated harbors, dedicated trains, dedicated boats, and it's not something that you can increase in the blink of an eye. So coal decreases. Then gas that is used in Europe is 60% coming from the North Sea, and the North Sea passes through its peak in 2005. And again, importing gas is not something that you do into the blink of an eye, because you have to build pipes, and building pipes takes a long, long time. You probably know it in the U.S. with the Keystone XL pipeline. And GNL, that you can bring by boat, is something that accounts for 10% of the world gas consumption. So it's not something which changes by and large figures. So gas production in Europe declines, and so gas consumption in Europe declines. And oil imports, oil production in Europe began to decline in 2000 in the North Sea. And oil imports in Europe began to decline in 2006, because from 2006 to 2012 or 2011, say, there is a long plateau on the world oil production, even if you include condensate. And so the ability to import of the historical importers, including US, decreases because China, namely, and India take more and more of the existing oil. So what happens is that oil plus gas plus coal are all on the decline. And so the energy supply in Europe declines. So the ability to operate a large number of machines declines. That means that the GDP declines, because euros or dollars, whatever, or pounds, they are just the economic way to count a transformation that the physicist can count in joules or British thermal units. So what happens after 2006 is that the industrial production and the GDP in Europe begins to decline. But Europe is a big market. In this big market, Romanians earn 300 euros per month. People in Hungary and people in Bulgaria and people in Poland, all these people earn far below 1,000 euros, so say $1,000 per month. Whereas in UK or in France, people earn much more than that. So what happens if you have a free and open market where you have no GDP growth overall, but still the ability to go wherever you want? Well, it happens that Poles move to London, and it happens that British industries close their factories in Great Britain and invest in Romania, as French industries do, as everybody else does. To name it with, I would say, words used by physicists, you have a global amount that doesn't change, in which you have huge differences of potential that soften, that get level. So what happens is that money flows from the West to the East. And then you ask the Britons whether they are happy with it, and they say no. And exactly the same way, you ask the Italians whether they are happy with it, and they say no. Exactly the same way, the Germans begin to say a little no. And in France, we have also a populist party, which is growing. And I believe that in the next elections, that will be the European elections next year, we'll have a huge no also coming from the French population. And that's due to the fact that Europe is a single market that thought its future only in a context of growth. Nothing is foreseen in the case there is no growth. So what happens, and actually that's something which is valid for many democracies, a future with no growth is something that so many people consider as unthinkable, including all these economists that get the so-called Nobel Prize in economy. They believe this is so unthinkable that nobody thinks on what to do if it happens for real. And actually, that's exactly what we experienced in Europe. The U.S. experienced exactly the same thing. I'm not sure that many people that will listen to us know that that to date, the absolute maximum for the U.S. energy supply was 2005. Today, the U.S. is still below. And actually, the GDP went up again. But when you look at the structure of what went up, you have the inflation of assets that accounts for a large fraction of what happened. And the fact that you have full employment is also due to the fact that the number of people that got out of the labor market during the crisis never came back to the market. So today, we are still in a situation in which we haven't recovered, so to say, from the 2006 and 2007 situation. And if you look at the chronological order of what happened, in 2006, maximum in the OECD zone of the energy supply, at the end of 2006, you see a deceleration in the GDP growth, and you see the real estate prices that begin to decline in the US, and that triggered all the rest. So it's not the fact that people in the finance industry have done nonsense, which is true, by the way, but it's not the fact, it's not sufficient to explain what happened. Now for Syria and other countries alike, we have witnessed a combination of an energy crisis and climate change. The energy crisis that I've just mentioned deprived Egypt and Tunisia of tourists. There are no tourists in Syria, so there's something else that plays a major role. Tourism in these countries accounts for 10 to 15% of the GDP. And these countries are otherwise major importers of food because they have a domestic population growth. And the domestic production of food cannot follow because of droughts, basically. I mean, it's not possible to grow enough food. And actually, droughts are increasing in the Mediterranean basin because of climate change. So these countries have to import plenty of food. Now, in 2010, we're in the aftermath of the energy crisis and therefore the economic crisis that I've just mentioned. So tourists are gone. These people need to import food. But tough luck, that year, food prices skyrocket for two reasons that add to each other. The first one is that oil prices rise again and you have a correlation between all commodities on financial markets. So basically when the price of oil goes up, the price of anything else goes up. And it's not because of inflation. It's because of the way asset managers act. And the second thing is that year, you have a huge heat wave with a huge fires and wood fires. And a huge contraction on the cereal production in Russia. And Russia that year says that it won't export cereals. So that's another reason for which overnight in July, I remember, the prices of cereal went up 30%. And these countries, Tunisia and Egypt, again, are massive importers. Tunisia roughly imports half of what the population eats. And Egypt is the largest wheat importer in the world, and it imports about a fourth of the cereal it uses, and then oil, whatever, meat, and plenty of other things. So what happens then is that prices of food go up, and they go up over what, let's say, the 30 or 40% of the population that are at the lower end of a bracket can afford to buy food. And so you have food riots. And as you probably know, if you have read history, food riots is a very good way to get rid of existing powers. It's also what happened in France in 1789. Just a year before, there was a huge hunger that killed almost a million people, and that triggered the French Revolution. So that's what happened in these two countries. In Syria, we have something close. The population of Syria and the food production of Syria grew alike until 2006. And then from 2006, under probably the increasing droughts in the Mediterranean basin and under the rise of the price of oil that prevents people from using too much machinery in the fields and too much water pumps, the food production begins to decrease. And Syria basically is not connected to the outside markets, cannot import anything because basically it doesn't export anything. So also you have all these people that move to the cities, and it adds on top of a situation that was already highly unstable. So of course it's not the only reasons that triggered what happened, but it directly contributed, energy and climate change, to what happened in Syria. And my belief is that all these are the early signals of what is going to increase around the world because of energy contraction and climate change.
You know, Jean-Marc, the energy peak oil movement and the climate change movement grew up as separate and then sort of discovered each other later. And there was quite a bit of discussion as though there were a race of which was going to endanger our civilization first, climate change or peak oil. And I think after the fracking explosion in the United States, that fell somewhat quiet, and people have been ignoring the limitations on energy and thinking that we have enough fuel to power our way directly into catastrophic climate change. Where do you place your bets on which is the greater threat coming soonest?
I place my bet on the fact that nobody will understand for both of these factors that is happening. So actually, when you look at what is happening today in Europe, which is obviously the place that I know the best, nobody talks of the fact that we have contraction of the energy supply. Nobody does. Nobody understands that it's something that we haven't chosen. Because if it were something that we had chosen, it wouldn't happen the same year everywhere. Because politicians are not the same everywhere, domestic measures are not the same everywhere. So if it were something that was a consequence of domestic policies, it wouldn't happen in 2006 in Greece and in Spain and in Italy and in France and in the UK and in the US. I mean, it doesn't fit. But I do not see in Europe a single government saying, oh, we have understood energy is machines. If machines work less, the GDP goes down. That exists nowhere. I'm not sure that it exists in the US, and I'm not sure that it existed during the mandate of Obama. Correct me if I'm wrong. So my bet is that governments don't understand this, and I have not seen very often, if at all, in the head of a political executive in Europe, the fact that climate change is already putting refugees on the road by large numbers. So a little more, so to say. And my bet is actually, I'm going to answer your question with another question. Suppose you put a pair of scissors on one of your fingers, okay, with one blade up and one blade down, and you increase the pressure, and you ask yourself the question, which blade is going to do you more harm? I think your answer will be, actually, your question has no sense. I mean, it's the fact that they press one against the other, which is going to harm me. It's exactly the same thing with climate change and energy. Actually, energy is the ability to change things into the world. So with infinite energy, you can address any adverse effect without limits, because you can correct anything without limits. So what is going to harm us is the conjunction of limited energy and increasing problems. That's what is going to harm us. So it's the conjunction of the fact that climate change is going to increase and energy is going to not increase much, then decrease, which is going to harm us. Let me take an example. Over 2 degrees, we will trigger the dismantling of the West Antarctic ice sheet. It's an ice sheet that relies on mountains, so there is a slope towards the ocean. And if the conditions become favorable, in quotes, so to say, that part of the ice cap is going to become unstable if we are on a path over 2 degrees. And once it has started to melt and dislocate, there is no going back because you have positive feedbacks everywhere. When that ice cap fully ends into the ocean, it's going to take a couple of centuries, but when it fully ends into the ocean, it's 6 meters extra for the ocean. We have the same process with Greenland. Actually, Greenland has begun to melt, and there also because of the positive feedbacks, it's going to continue melting for the centuries and millennia to come, and that's also 3 to 6 meters extra for the world ocean. So 6 plus 6, plus the fact that the ocean is going to rise because warm water occupies more volume than cold water. So the fact that water dilates when you heat it is going to add to the ocean level increase. So just wait if we go over 2 degrees, and one day Netherlands will be under the water. A significant fraction of Florida, a significant fraction of Louisiana, a significant fraction of New York, etc. All this will be under the water, including Bangkok and Shanghai. Well, you understand that to displace all these cities in the blink of an eye without fossil fuels is something that you just can't do. So it's the conjunction of the two, because in 5 centuries, there will be no fossil fuels or very little fossil fuels. And today it's fossil fuels that allow to manufacture cement in large quantities, iron in large quantities, have trucks that bring all this in large amounts, cranes that allow to erect all this quickly, etc., etc. Notre Dame, that was built 1,000 years ago, it took a century to build it. Now a tower in Manhattan takes 6 months or a year. So this is because of energy. So what is going to hurt us, to end this long answer to your short question, is the conjunction of the fact that having less energy is something that means that we'll have less ways to master our destiny, and at the same time, we will confront to a growing climate change. And something that I should add, because it's something that many people probably don't have in hand, in their minds, the amount of time that you must wait for a surplus of CO2 to evacuate from the atmosphere is over 10,000 years. So there is nothing such as a reset button for climate change. The only thing that we are sure of is that the day consequences will become unbearable or perceived as unbearable, it will then become worse later on. It's the only certainty we have. So, it's a certainty we have. So, it's the conjunction of the two that is going to harm us, exactly as if you put the two blades of scissors on top and on the bottom of your finger. It's the pressure on both blades at the same time which is going to hurt you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to our discussion with a French expert in energy and climate change. From Paris, it is Jean-Marc Jancovici. So, Jean-Marc, your latest book is Dormez tranquille jusqu'à l'an Vincent et autres malentendus sur le climat et l'énergie. That is loosely translated as Sleep Quiet Until 2100 and Other Misunderstandings About Climate and Energy. Can you give us a short introduction in English to that work? What's it about?
It's about the fact that in the energy and climate change debate, and actually, I didn't answer a small part of your question, which is, indeed, the world of energy and the world of climate change were two worlds that didn't talk to each other for a very simple reason. It's that people the visible or the major NGOs into environmental issues were globally saying regarding the largest actors in the energy sector, you are our enemies. And if somebody is your enemy, you don't try to understand what he or she does. So people that wanted to explain both what climate change is and what energy is, actually, we still are. There still are very few of us. I'm, for example, a member of ASPO in France, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Most people that come from the oil sector consider that people that are in the climate change sector are people that do not address the main problem. And most people that work in the climate change sector just don't know what an energy system is. So it's true that there are not that many people. It happens that my personal history made me coming across both of these topics, but it's something which is a kind of luck. I mean, it wasn't made on purpose. Now, to come back to the book. The book is based on the fact that because of the simplifications made by the press, people that debate on energy or on climate change issues most of the time debate on misunderstandings. The title of the book, Sleep Well Until 2100, actually was given because in the climate change issue, something that you most probably have heard all the time is, if we do nothing, then we will have 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees or whatever in 2100. And when you hear that 100 times, most people that otherwise are not specialists and their major issues are, am I going to get out of of my job early enough to pick up the kids at school? have I forgotten or not to buy bread this morning, and etc. When they hear this and they are not specialists, basically they develop a reflex of understanding that until the 31st of December of 2099, nothing will happen. Basically, if we risk something for 2100, there is an implicit in this sentence, which is that before that date, we risk nothing. So the title of the book was there to recall that, of course, things will happen before 2100. And it's not because people that perform simulations in climate change, in the climate change debate, using numerical models, perform their simulations until 2100, that nothing is going to happen before. It's a little less true now. I mean, the debate has progressed a little because things are becoming true. I mean, things, you're not going to learn that California has witnessed its largest, or some of its largest wildfires in history last summer. So something is becoming real. So now people understand that 2100 was only a conventional date in the numerical models used by physicists. But a couple of years ago, I mean, my book was written in 2010, it was not true. Among the other misunderstandings that I develop, or that I try to address in this book, there is the fact that I developed before, that the 2000 crisis is not before anything else a financial crisis. It's before anything else an energy crisis, actually a double energy crisis. The first trigger was pulled in 1973, might recall it, the first oil shock, because that was a sudden change in oil production that before that date was growing by 8-9% per year in the world. And just after that, it fell to plus 1% in the world on average for the 30 years that followed. So that sudden change in the energy supply, well, in the oil supply, triggered a sudden change in the energy supply, and actually it triggered the stop of the growth of the energy supply per capita, that is the machine fleet per capita, in all OECD countries. Therefore, to be able to continue to spend money at a growing rate of 3-4% per year, because the system that were installed in all the Western states was to spend money, and namely public spendings, with a growth rate of 3-4% per year, you couldn't sustain this unless you begin to borrow. And so external debt began to exist and grow, but exist in some countries. I mean, France didn't have any external debt in 73. It began to grow from that date. And then in 2005, a second thing happened. Oil growth in the world stopped, and the oil supply in OECD countries began to decrease. And that hit hard because of the contraction of the GDP that followed. A stockpile of debt that began to grow until the first oil shock. So what happened in 2008 is a double energy crisis, 73, then 2005, and it is not primarily a financial crisis that we will fix with financial fixes, and then the world growth can go on as it did before. It is not going to become true. And actually, we have now all the early warnings of a new crisis coming along, because the shale oil boom that you just mentioned in one of the previous questions is coming to a halt right now. You probably know that in the U.S. there is a bubble on the debt of shale oil frackers. All these people, they don't earn positive cash flow, so they have a little problem reimbursing their debt. And you have a kind of Ponzi pyramid that is being built on this sector of the economy. So right now, there is another huge misunderstanding still, is that energy is a sector in the economy and not the blood of the economy. So that's another thing that I addressed in my book. Another one, I've just discussed it. It's the fact that the riots that happened in Tunisia and Egypt in 2010 were riots for democracy. It was not. It was riots for food because of energy and climate change issues, among other things. I'm also discussing the Brexit and the fact that in France, our populist party is also our own domestic Trump, I could say, is also gaining audience. All this is a consequence of the fact that the European GDP came to a halt for energy issues, etc. So all this that I'm developing into this book is the fact that if you take your energy glasses to look at what's happening, plenty of things become logical and connected, but also very, it makes you very anxious. But then you understand that we are embarked on a course that we won't halt in a week. I mean, something which is governed by very long-term trends, and it's going to be very difficult to reverse the trend with short-term measures.
Yes, Jean-Marc, what do you make? You mentioned the sort of Trump in France developing. What do you make of the withdrawal of major polluting countries from climate change action as the United States even withdrew from the Paris Accord and the rightist leader, probably going to be elected in Brazil, is claiming he will do the same? How do you see that playing into this picture we've just been talking about?
The first answer that I'm going to give you is a historical one. Between 1965 and 2017, the CO2 content of a dollar of GDP in Europe was divided by three. In the US, that, as you know, didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol, that pulled off from the Paris Agreement, by how much do you believe that CO2 emissions per dollar of GDP were divided in the same period? The answer is by three. So my opinion is that what these political leaders do is of basically no importance. What is important is what people that really, or I'm going to be more precise. It is important, but it's not the main driver of what is happening. What is the main driver of what is happening is what large corporations will do, is what citizens will do, is what local governments will do, is what trade unions will do. I mean, elected presidents are one among many of the actors that have to and that can play a role. You see, for example, in the U.S., the fact that the CO2 emissions coming from electricity production decreased over the last 10 or 15 years has nothing to do with Obama and actually nothing to do with Trump. And when Trump says that he's going to revive coal, I mean, he can just as well tweet on something else. He has no influence on what is happening, because what is happening today in the U.S. is that producing electricity with shale gas costs less than producing electricity with coal. That's why coal is going down and gas is going up and the CO2 emissions coming from electricity production are going down. It has nothing to do with Obama and nothing to do with Trump. So the importance of having a political leader saying, I want to be in or I don't want to be in, is something which is not the only, reason why things happen. Let me give you, ask you a question. Suppose that tomorrow morning, both Europe and Japan and the U.S. have major economic actors that say we all have a vested interest in the fact that the Amazon forest remains in good shape. So we are ready to pay people to keep the Amazon forest in good shape, because if we don't do this, the world climate goes haywire and we don't want it. And we are going to establish a flow of money going to people that are going to do something sound with the Amazon forest instead of cutting it to grow soybeans. Do you think that the Brazilian president is still going to be a climate skeptic? I doubt it. So basically what these people do is that they respond to external pressures, just as I said before. This guy actually has no conviction by himself. He just doesn't care. He has voters. He has lobbyists. And that's what drives his action. If tomorrow morning he can understand that he puts his country into a better shape, caring of the issue than not caring of the issue, he will do it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock with our guest Jean-Marc Jancovici. You know, I've been thinking about how sad it is in a way that your work is walled away from us, most of it, by language differences. And again, there's so much good work in German that is closed off to me. But eventually, and maybe not too far away, machines will accurately translate your book to English. And in fact, the barriers to world languages will fall. Now, would that start a new intellectual revolution, or could it be dangerous as well if everybody can talk to everybody anywhere?
That's a good question. I think it does actually. I'm going to give you two answers. I think that as a whole, the world IT and telecommunication system is an emission enabler. It is an emission enabler in two ways. One way, and that's going to be translated into English, it happens that the NGO that I have created 7 years ago, the SHIFT Project, that basically advocates going to a low-carbon economy because it's a good idea to do so in the long term. Basically, it's the economic optimum in a way. We have to preserve assets that are indispensable to preserve a productive system. Even though in the productive system, we never take these natural assets into account. Without them, we just cannot produce. I mean, if tomorrow morning you put somebody into the interstellar vacuum with no resource, even though he has trained and skilled workers and a very nice banker, he won't produce anything. So if you don't have resources, you don't produce. So preserving resources is something that you need in order to preserve a productive system. So in the long run, actually, advocating for a low-carbon economy is advocating for something that it can be sustained in the productive system. Otherwise, we won't sustain anything. So going back to what I said, so the SHIFT project just released in French, but it's currently being translated. So if you're interested, it will be my pleasure to send it to you once it's translated. A work that we have performed on the carbon footprint of the world IT and computer, information technology system. That's the combination of personal computers, servers, networks, cables, telecommunication lines, satellites, etc., and the electricity that runs all this. Well, if you pile up all this, so including production of the device that we use to run the global telecommunication and IT system, it amounts today to 4% of the world emissions, which is globally about the emissions of the world truck fleet. So this, and it's growing by 10% per year. So the first way to answer your question on IT, if I understood correctly that it was a question on IT, is that notwithstanding what Apple and Google say, today the global IT system is an emission enabler because it is a sector that leads to emissions because of the upstream mines, because of the upstream chemical industries, because of the upstream metal industry that is required to manufacture all the device, and because of the coal power plants, 40% of the electricity in the world, and the gas power plants, 25% of the electricity in the world, that are required to operate all this, even though some people say that they operate on 100% renewable electricity, which is not even true, but it's okay. Now, the second thing for which it is an emission enabler, I'm going to demonstrate it by the absurd. Suppose that tomorrow morning, all the IT system vanishes. All the computers vanish overnight, all the telecommunication lines vanish overnight, etc. What happens? We have no money anymore, because money today is basically something written in a computer, as you probably know. Banknotes, at least in France, I don't know what it's like in the US, but I suppose it's close. Banknotes and coins, it's 1/30 of the global monetary mass. So you're not going to run the economy only with this. You have no communication system, so all large organizations cannot run anymore. You have no water pumps, so all the cities are deprived of potable water. They are deprived of what comes out in the toilets, name it. It's evacuated elsewhere. You're deprived of cops, because cops cannot operate without communication system, etc., etc. So basically, you have a collapse. And if you have a collapse, of course, CO2 emissions will contract. So this little demonstration by the absurd shows in a very simple way that today the global IT system in the world sustains huge flows and therefore a huge use of energy. So the idea, and your question on whether it was a good or a bad thing that everybody can talk to everybody else is actually something that cannot exist if you do not have a global IT system. Okay, if you do not have that, it just cannot exist. So the good thing right now is that the global IT system will enable me to talk to a fraction of your audience that might regret it. But for sure, it is something, the global IT system, which pushes the emissions up instead of pushing them down. It's uncomfortable to hear, but unfortunately, it's a fact.
Yes, although, and we don't really have time to get into the other side of my question, which is perhaps it's better that we are all isolated in separate language or tribal streams. And once we really are able to talk to each other, perhaps that would allow some central power to offer propaganda to all of us in a single language. I mean, we don't have time to go there. But I would like to ask you, you said in your Paris lecture of January 2018, because the energy at large doesn't grow, anything that someone wins is something someone else will lose. It sounds very Darwinian. Your vision makes us almost a secondary agency, not only to machines, but to energy itself. And I got this picture that billions of us have almost evolved like insects to become fossil fuel parasites. Is that too dark or is that true?
What do you mean? I'm not sure I got the question.
Well, you have just explained all throughout this talk how totally dependent we are on fossil fuels at this point.
Yes.
And, you know, without them, I would say billions of people would die.
Yeah, probably.
So we can say, in a way, we have changed from whatever natural animal we were to now become very complex fossil fuel parasites. We have to live off this other food.
Parasites. Yeah. In a way, yes. We are fossil fuels, symbiotic animals.
Yes.
like the mushrooms that depend on the tree.
Exactly. All right. Now, what are you working on next?
Just a couple of things. As you said at the beginning, my work is to be a consultant. And actually, I'm the founder of a company that now amounts to a modest 50 people. And we try to confront economic activities to the energy and climate constraints, basically. I hope that before I die, a significant fraction of the budget today devoted to McKinsey, Bain & Company, the Boston Consulting Group, and Harvard economists gets devoted to my company, because we try to put physical limits into the business that will happen anyway, and it's probably helpful for people. So that's my tremendous professional ambition, I should say. With the SHIFT project, my ambition is to try to convince people that have the time to listen to complex explanations, just like the people that listen to us right now, that we have something which deserves much greater attention, because all the rest is correlated to that, or linked to that. And that if you take going low carbon as I would say, the root of a political program, it's something which is holistic, and you can plug all the rest on it with something which is very easy to explain and very easy to advocate. So that, I would say, is my associative ambition. Now, regarding books, unfortunately, nights have become too short. So my editor has been trying to convince me for the last 4 years to write a new one. But I don't know when I will be able to say yes to him. But if I do so, I'm not sure it's going to be very, very good for my clients. But if I do so, I think that the next one, I would like to do Econ Greenwashing. Because one other thing that dispels me is that the complacent behavior of most of the media today that accept the greenwashing of the companies that otherwise finance the advertisement budget, so finance the media, and they accept that to, I would say, relay the light put on solutions that treat 1% of the problem and a full silence on the rest. And that's something that you can witness everywhere. I mean, all companies, they come with a corporate speech that says, we're addressing the issue, look at what we're doing, we're doing this and that. And actually, when you do the math, they're addressing 1% to 2% to 10% of the issue. I've recently learned that the S&P 500 companies in the U.S. are going to spend $1 billion on buybacks this year. And the CEOs of all these companies, right hand on their heart, are going to say that they really want to save the planet, and they're not going to spend 1% of this amount on serious actions to understand and address the issue. So probably if I do a next book, it's going to be on this huge, I would say, greenwashing and hypocrisy that we are witnessing today.
All these voices that whisper in our ear, sleep well until 2100, my darlings. So, from Paris, we've been speaking with the French author and consultant on energy and climate, Jean-Marc Jancovici. I will put links to his website and other materials in my weekly show blog published at ecoshock.org. Jean-Marc, it has been really stimulating talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Millions of us in the west of North America, Scandinavia, and Russia went through a summer of fear and smoke in 2018 as record forest fires filled the air. Was that a burst of carbon to the atmosphere? And what does it mean? Next week, I'll ask a widely known expert, Professor John C. Lynn from the Land-Atmosphere Interactions Research Group at the University of Utah. Then we're off to England for another deep science interview with Dr. Edward Hanna from the University of Lincoln. There is something going on over Greenland that can steer hurricanes into coastal cities in the United States and Canada. Oh, yeah. And summer pressure in Greenland can rain out the UK and Northern Europe and change the sea level around the world. Be sure and tune in to Radio EcoShock next week. Sometimes a phrase can appear out of the fog. This week it is an old English saying, whistling past the graveyard. There are two ways to interpret this phrase. Wiktionary.org gives two definitions, and consider these as reactions to the horrors of climate change as well. To attempt to stay cheerful in a dire situation, to proceed with the task, ignoring an upcoming hazard, hoping for a good outcome, or to enter a situation with little or no understanding of the possible consequences. This all came to me reading tweets about Donald Trump. A tweeter named Puesto Loco said Robert Mueller should tell the voting public if current candidates are suspected of crimes or even treason. If not, says Puesto, Mueller whistles past the future graves. Isn't that what we do as we drive around and shop? As we vote for climate deniers because we like their other policies? As we whistle along through these fossil-powered illusions, the future graves may be millions on the other side of the world, or for our descendants, or maybe ourselves. Hey, it's a Halloween horror show here on Radio EcoShock. Check out my weekly blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. This is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Whistling Past the Graveyard.
Train with an arm full of boxcars on the wings of a magpie across a hooligan night. Busted up a chaperone way out by the Kokomo. Cooked up a mess of mulligan and got into a fight. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, Papa One-Eyed Jack. You've probably seen me sleeping out by the railroad tracks. Asked the Prince of Darkness about the smoke from the stack. Sometimes I kill a jackal and suck out all the blood. Steal myself a station wagon, drive it into the mud. A whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack. I know you've seen my headlight and the honking of my horn. I'm calling out my bloodhound, chase the devil out the corn. Last night I cracked the Mississippi, and now it's dry as a bone. I was born in a taxi cab, I ain't never going home. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack. My eyes have seen the glory of the draining of the ditch. I'm coming to Baton Rouge to find myself a witch. I'm gonna switch me a couple of them every time it rains. You gotta see a locomotive, probably think it's a train. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. I'm a mean mother hubba, papa, one-eyed jack.
just think it's sunshine, it's just a twinkle in my eye. I got a ring around my finger called the 4th of July. When I get lonesome, a tear falls from my cheek. There's gonna be an ocean in the middle of the week. Whistling past the graveyard, stepping on a crack. Me, Mother Hubba Papa, One-Eyed Jack. I come in on the night train with an arm full of boxcars. On the wings of a magpie across a hooligan night. I'm gonna tear off a rainbow and wear it for a tie. I never told the truth, so how in the hell could I tell a lie? Whistling past the graveyard.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In early October, an investigation by The Forward revealed that the Jewish Community Federation of San Francisco, the Peninsula, Marin, and Sonoma counties, a major communal organization that funds Jewish cultural and community programs, has also been a top funder of Canary Mission, the anonymous blacklisting website that aims to tarnish the reputations of U.S. supporters of Palestinian rights. Recently released documents also prove that Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs has been using Canary Mission, quote, to bar political activists from entering Israel, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz, corroborating testimonies by activists, students, and human rights lawyers. The ministry is in charge of Israel's global war against the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement, an effort that reportedly involves the use of clandestine black ops. This week, Chicago-based researcher Stephanie Skora, who's also a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, revealed that the Jewish Community Federation has not only been a top funder of Canary Mission, but of a slew of other far-right-wing, anti-Muslim, and homophobic groups going back at least 15 years and to the tune of more than $300 million since. Skora writes, quote, outright fascists such as Geert Wilders, described by Time magazine as the Dutch Trump, and Turning Point USA, a group regularly aligned with white supremacists, feature prominently in the JCF's 990 forms, its compulsory annual filings with the federal government. Bizarrely, even organizations with deep ties to anti-Semitism benefited from the JCF's funding, such as the Tea Party Patriots Foundation and the Zionist Organization of America, which invited notorious Jew hater Steve Bannon to speak at their annual gathering twice. Joining us to talk about the significance of her findings amid the new revelations about Canary Mission and its funding structures is Stephanie Skora. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The revelations came out about the Jewish Community Federation authorizing at least $100,000 to the Helen Diller Foundation to support Canary Mission through some shady auxiliary organization named Megamot Shalom, which was found to be basically an abandoned building west of Jerusalem. After the Forward's report was published, the Federation admitted that it had funded Canary Mission and said it wouldn't do it again. But less than a week later, you uncovered a trove of financial documents that prove that the Federation and the Helen Diller Foundation didn't just fund Canary Mission, this right-wing blacklist, as a one-time fluke, but that it's part of a pattern of steady financing of really right-wing, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian, pro-hate groups across the country. Can you talk about what prompted you to dive in here and what your research shows?
Yeah, so I was prompted partially by the Forward article that exposed the Diller Foundation as funding Canary Mission. But the Jewish Federation of San Francisco, the JCF, also funds the pinkwashing group A Wider Bridge. They're one of their large funders. They've given over $100,000 to them over several years. And I am currently in the middle of doing some significant research on all of A Wider Bridge's funders because I believe that they're linked to the Islamophobia industry. And that led me to the JCF. And I did quite extensive research on them, as my article shows. And then the JCF led me to the Diller Foundation through the Forward. And so really, this was partially because I'm a committed anti-pinkwashing activist. I had a lot of this information already, and I'm compiling it as part of a larger report on A Wider Bridge's funders. But the information that I found about the Diller Foundation, and then when I went back, I was able to find the 2017 990 forms for the JCF. The information on there was just so explosive, I figured I should just put that stuff out right away because people need to know about this stuff.
You published all of your findings on Medium.com in a post titled "The Jewish Federation of San Francisco and the Helen Diller Family Foundation Fund Far-Right and Anti-Muslim Groups, and I Can Prove It."
Yes.
Talk a little more about some of the other findings here. For example, the David Horowitz Freedom Center and the Foundation of for Defense of Democracies, which you found received grants totaling over $800,000 over several years, as well as the Geert Wilders-linked International Freedom Alliance Foundation. What have these organizations promoted exactly, and why is it important to focus in on their activities and the funding sources here?
So all of the organizations that I covered in the article, they came into three main categories. All of them were involved, though, in some way in anti-Muslim or anti-Palestinian rhetoric, bigotry, and pushing anti-Muslim and anti-Palestinian narratives. The three main kinds of organizations were just out-and-out anti-Muslim hate groups, many of them appearing on the Southern Poverty Law Center's list of hate groups or associated with individuals who are anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant extremists. And then there were campus-based groups, which often work quite closely with these Islamophobic groups to push these narratives on college campuses, stifle pro-BDS and pro-Palestine activism, and just generally vilify Muslim students on campus, whether or not they're associated with Palestine. Many of the organizations that I covered have wild conspiracy theories about creeping Sharia on college campuses in major U.S. cities, and go so far as to demonize student organizations which aren't explicitly political, like the Muslim Student Association, which I'm sure listeners to the podcast know has been widely demonized as associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that that's not true.
Yeah.
And then the third category are like media watch groups and censorship groups, the likes of the American Media Institute, which is linked to Project Veritas, which came up during the Roy Moore election as trying to smear liberal media by putting out false sexual assault allegations. This group called Honest Reporting, which harasses journalists that provide accurate coverage of Palestine. And then the Middle East Media Research Institute, CAMRA, and a whole slew of others.
One of those categories that you mentioned was, the campus activism, organizations meant to censor, threaten, and target campus activists for Palestinian rights, including, the Amcha Initiative, the American Israel Education Foundation, Hasbara Fellowships, Students Supporting Israel, one of the most notorious, Stand With Us, which received more than $1.2 million, you found.
Yes.
The Israel Project, which received almost $2 million. And the Israel on Campus Coalition, Turning Point, like all of these organizations.
Horrible, horrible groups that are all like very closely linked together.
Right.
And that's mostly through the Israel on Campus Coalition as of recent years. They've really brought a lot of these groups under their purview and have worked quite closely with Canary Mission and the people who run Canary Mission. There was this excellent article that the Electronic Intifada put out not so long ago that was the leaked clip of the movie that was supposed to come out.
The Al Jazeera documentary.
Yeah. Yes. And that article actually does a really good job of linking together all of these different organizations and how, besides the JCF, they also share other funders, all attend the same conferences, and work quite closely to develop and put out these blacklists.
The Jewish Community Federation also funds, not so right-wing organizations, sort of, more community organizations, hospitals,
Absolutely.
Scholarships. But they do not fund anymore groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, groups that are more leftist or progressive leaning that do take stands in support of BDS. So you have this, on the one hand, they're supporting far right wing, very virulent, anti-Muslim, anti-Palestinian organizations, but have taken, a line against Jewish Voice for Peace, for example. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that shows about where the priorities for the Jewish Federation lie right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, it paints this really clear picture of where the Jewish Federation of San Francisco, the JCF, sees itself as part of larger communal life for Jews in the country and specifically in the Bay Area. It really sees itself as ostensibly a PEP organization, but a PEP organization, a progressive except Palestine organization, that is willing to go so far right on the question of Israeli sovereignty and the existence of the state of Israel, and silencing and brutalizing even Palestinians who dare to exist on college campuses or in the media, that the other progressive donations that it's made wind up getting wiped out. There's this really interesting thing that the JCF has done, both by itself and through its supporting foundation, the Helen Diller Foundation, is that they're actually, of all the Jewish charities that I've looked through, they probably are one of the top three or five givers to LGBTQ causes, which makes sense because they're located in the Bay Area. They have a lot of money, you know, those hand in hand sort of, you're in the Bay Area, you're a big organization, you give to LGBTQ causes. But they also gave to really, really right-wing and explicitly homophobic organizations like the Heritage Foundation, which is notoriously anti-gay, as far back as the Reagan administration and still to this day supports things as what would have become no-brainers like same-sex marriage. And it's really interesting that the Federation seems to be talking out of both sides of its mouth, giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to progressive causes. They even funded the Southern Poverty Law Center and ProPublica, which is where I found a lot of this information about them. There were a number of really interesting contradictions in their donations where they funded organizations that worked in directly to combat the hate groups they also funded. And it really, I think, speaks volumes to where the JCF sees its political priorities, is it seeks to be this progressive Jewish organization that funds aspects of American life and progressive and liberal causes in the U.S., but as I said before, is willing to go so far right as a pro-Israel organization that they fund some of the nastiest people that the country has to offer. And in the case of Geert Wilders, the world. And some of these people are known anti-Semites. And you run into this contradiction where you have this major Jewish organization funding the work of anti-Semites to promote the interests of the Israeli state. And you wonder, you know, what are these federations doing ostensibly behind closed doors, but then also completely out in the open and in documents that are a matter of public record. And that to me says that they're not ashamed of this giving, despite the statements that they give out and the promises to stop funding Canary Mission. Like, do we need a promise for all like 60 organizations that they've funded on this list? Like, do they have to release one statement each? Like, where does it end?
That's the voice of Stephanie Skora. Stephanie, what do you hope your research, along with the recent revelations about the Federation's funding of Canary Mission, can do for activists, researchers, and advocates of free speech and human rights, especially on college campuses where this has become a battleground, and especially in the American Jewish community?
Yeah, I really think that this has the potential to do a lot of very important work in terms of not only the transparency of major Jewish organizations that claim to speak for their respective Jewish communities. Those communities need to hold them to account. I'm quite sure that most of the Jews in the Bay Area would be horrified to learn that the JCF funded the Tea Party. And the Bay Area being one of the most Democratic-leaning places in the whole country, donations to the furthest right part of the Republican Party would be met with quite a bit of scorn from the community. And on college campuses, it's really helpful for students to be able to know when they're fighting against groups such as Students Supporting Israel, the Israel on Campus Coalition, or even just right-wing groups associated with their local Hillel. It's helpful for them to know where their funding is coming from, because often student governments aren't able to make that connection. And when they're faced with a JVP or an SJP chapter and this group that claims to represent all Jews on campus, they unfortunately wind up listening to the Hillel chapter more often than not. And so this is going to be a really good tool for student organizations to be able to say, look, these pro-Israel organizations are coming to you and claiming to represent these things, but their funding is coming from people who also fund these interests. And I think that really those connections, the like direct line connections between people like Geert Wilders, people like David Yerushalmi, Daniel Pipes, Steve Emerson, Frank Gaffney, these incredible bigots, and funding that is going directly to, in many cases, Hillels and pro-Israel organizations on campus will be a huge boon for pro-Palestine student activists to be able to point out very clearly to people who oppose them in student governments and school administrations that they're being hoodwinked. These groups that claim to speak for the interests of Jews on campus are in fact representing the Israeli state, and they have the right-wing funding to prove it. And bigger picture, I have this vision that, you know, the Jewish community can do better than these federations. They give all this money to things, but the federations don't get this money on their own. Every dollar that these federations get is from the Jewish community in some way, shape, or form. This is Jewish communal money. And the Jewish community doesn't want our money spent that way. At least the vast majority of us don't. And so I really envision this future where we're able to cut out these federations and stop using them as essentially the power brokers of the Jewish community, and we can give Jewish communal money directly to organizations that we want to support. And so if people want to give to people like Daniel Pipes, the Middle East Forum, CAMRA, the Clarion Fund, or Turning Point, they should have to own that themselves. They should have to say, my name is X, and I want to give my money to right-wingers and fascists, rather than using the Jewish communal institutions, who apparently are all too willing to do it for them, to pass that money along. Because there are a lot of organizations that would be more progressive on causes like prison abolition, fighting back against police brutality, Palestinian human rights, and Islamophobia, if it weren't for the Jewish federations who they depend on for funding, holding them to specific viewpoints.
Again, Stephanie Skora, her piece is on Medium.com. The post is titled, "The Jewish Federation of San Francisco and the Helen Diller Family Foundation Fund Far-Right and Anti-Muslim Groups, and I Can Prove It." We'll link to that piece on the Electronic Intifada. And Stephanie Skora, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast, and we look forward to more research from you in the future.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chip Berlay, an author and researcher on racism and intolerance, who discusses the link between Donald Trump's toxic rhetoric and the recent spasm of politically driven violence across the U.S. Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the grave concern over the fate of Brazil after the country elected extremist right-wing candidate Jair Bolsonaro president. And Paul Rink, a Yale Law School student, who explains why he organized a rally in support of the Children's Climate Change lawsuit recently put on hold by the U.S. Supreme Court. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the Palestinian-Israeli peace process has broken down, frustration has peaked, with more Arab citizens seeking to run for municipal office. Violating a 50-year Palestinian Authority boycott of local elections, Palestinian engineer and activist Ramadan Dabash is running for city council in East Jerusalem to fight for better streets and quality education for Palestinian children. Aziz Abu Sara, a Palestinian political and social activist, recently quit his effort to run for mayor of Jerusalem on a decidedly political anti-occupation platform after being pressured by both the Israeli and Palestinian sides to drop out. Local politicking is still a hard sell for many Palestinians because East Jerusalem is occupied land and participating in elections is seen by many Arabs as accepting Israeli domination. East Jerusalem is one of the poorest parts of either the West Bank or Israel. According to some estimates, as many as 70% of its Palestinian residents live below the poverty line. There is great bitterness over Israeli home demolitions that often follow the building of homes or extensions of homes by Palestinians without permits that East Jerusalemites claim are nearly impossible to procure from a city that views them as a demographic threat. On Election Day, November 6th, voters in the Republican-dominated state of Arkansas will vote on raising the minimum wage to $11 an hour by 2021. Today, only California and Massachusetts have a minimum wage as high as $11 per hour. The measure is popular. A state poll found 60% of voters are in favor of the idea. It nevertheless has been challenged by the state's Republican Attorney General and Arkansas's Chamber of Commerce. In 2014, when Arkansas voters raised their minimum wage to its current level from the federal floor of $7.25, those voters also elected Republicans across the board to state and federal office, despite the party's lack of support for the minimum wage increase. If voters again cast a ballot for an initiative that enjoys broad support while at the same time voting against the party that uniformly supports the measure, it might just be a sign of how tribal partisanship has become. Voters elect their representatives without regard for or even despite where they stand on some issues, part of an increasing pattern of red state voters casting their ballots against their own economic self-interest. In a shift since 2016, young Americans, according to recent polling, view socialism more favorably than capitalism. The public has been embracing ideas like Medicare for all and a federally guaranteed job, tilting the energy in the Democratic Party toward its progressive wing. Labor unions have been edging up in popularity and scored a ballot initiative win this year, even in Republican-dominated Missouri. There's growing support for worker ownership through worker cooperatives. If the 2011 Occupy Wall Street protest was a relatively short-lived movement, its spirit seems to be persisting and even expanding. Increasing support for progressive policy solutions among millennials has been inspired by massive student debt, sky-high rents, rising economic inequality, and growing poverty. The upset primary victory of Bronx native Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put the resurgent Democratic Socialists of America on the political map. The DSA has recruited over 40,000 new members since Trump's election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The past week has seen some of the worst politically driven violence in recent American history. On October 24th, a white supremacist with a history of violence shot and killed two African Americans at a Kroger grocery store after he attempted to gain entry into a black church outside Louisville, Kentucky. Just 2 days earlier, the first of 14 pipe bombs were discovered addressed to liberal Jewish philanthropist George Soros, who, along with the 13 other bombing targets, that included prominent Democratic Party officials and cable news network CNN, had been frequently vilified by President Trump. The Florida man, later arrested for sending the mail bombs, was an ardent Trump supporter who embraced many of the president's bogus conspiracy theories. Then on October 27th, a man carrying an AR-15 assault rifle and three handguns shot and killed 11 congregants at a Pittsburgh synagogue, wounding four police officers and two others, as he shouted, "All Jews must die." The Pittsburgh Synagogue Massacre, the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in U.S. history, was provoked by the gunman's belief in a conspiracy theory that a caravan of Central American refugees headed to the U.S. border was part of a Jewish plot. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, and activist who's written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he examines the rise in hate crimes by violent right-wing individuals and groups, and the connection of these crimes to President Trump's toxic, hateful rhetoric.
If a very popular leader who is high up, doesn't matter whether it's political or religious or movement leader, basically alleges that some group of people is conspiring against the common good, and they sort of harp on that for a long time, it's only a matter of time before people get killed. That has been the middle of the sociology of this kind of situation since the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and it tracks back to the research that was done into the Nazi movement.
And Chip, how directly can the current climate we're living through be traced to the rhetoric of one Donald Trump, who has certainly done his best to provoke people's fear and hatred as his campaign modus operandi? It really seems very deliberate, and it's worked very well for him.
Well, it's not clear if it's deliberate, because this is not the brightest star in the sky who is our president. So I think it's just his natural nastiness and bigotry that comes out whether or not he's president. My brother actually went to school with Donald Trump at New York Military Academy, and you know, in later years, he would admit that, as he would say, Donald Trump was a really good baseball player, not very smart. Oh, and he was a bully and a jerk. So you come into this with the idea that he's a bully, and now he's president, and he's never really been in a position in his entire life, because of family wealth and elite rule, to be challenged on these ideas, so that he basically thinks that he can free form this kind of rhetoric without any sense of responsibility as a president, but without caring about the fact that he's coming across as a bigot.
Chip, I wanted to ask you in particular about a segment I saw on Fox News recently where Laura Ingraham, the host, was railing against the diseases that these immigrants who are traveling up from Central America, primarily Honduras and Guatemala through Mexico, and which has been a target for President Trump and the Fox News Network in recent days. She complained that these people would be bringing disease to the country. And I reflexively remembered in history that the Nazi Party targeted the minority groups that they were trying to demonize with pretty much the same kind of broad brush, saying that they carried diseases. And lo and behold, I looked it up. There it was. The whole history of the Nazi Party accusing various minority groups that were being persecuted by the Nazis as carrying disease. So Fox News tore our page right out of history here, a very dark history.
It's a vicious history. It's a genocidal history. You know, it's much better to use a hard word to describe this history. And in fact, if you go online and look up the Der Stürmer kind of records, that was the Nazi newspaper, and look at the language, look at the pictures, look at the characterization of Jews. They're not just disease carriers. They bring socialism, they bring rape, they bring all kinds of money manipulation. So we're basically now looking at people like Soros and seeing a direct historic relationship to the accusations against Soros, George Soros, with the Nazi movement of the 1930s. So it's really quite amazing that finally, when CNN came on 8 o'clock, they basically announced they weren't going to talk about the name of the shooter in Pittsburgh. They weren't going to talk about all these comments from political people. They're going to start by naming the victims. And I think that's really what has to happen. We spend so much time on the mainstream media talking about names, facts, killings, blood, and then we go to a cut to somebody who has a political or ideological point of view, pontificating, right, you know, pulling it out of their butt and talking about stuff they know nothing about. And all too much, even on the left media now, you have people talking about these kinds of actions and what promotes them without any knowledge that there's 50, 60 years of social science that explains all this in detail. It's just if it isn't on the web, it doesn't exist.
in the context of what we're living through right now, the extremist hate, the racism and bigotry and the violence, how important in your view is this midterm election coming up November 6th in repudiating the politicians and party that seem to be promoting and advocating such hatred?
Well, it's a two-step process. You know, I think it's time to take power away from the very bizarre set of authoritarian and self-referential Republicans who have taken over the party. There's really four or five different sectors of the right that have united to support Trump and the current libertarian kind of greedster agenda, but also very masculinist, also very anti-kind of intellectual. So I think we need to elect Democrats, not because we think they're going to solve the problem, but because, you know, we'd like to be able to have these conversations in 2 years rather than all being, you know, sitting around in a camp somewhere talking about the revolution or the Democrats or whether Hillary was the right person to pick. I think we need to stop what's happening now. That's crucial, and that's going to be by electing Democrats, but that is not the solution in the long run. When the solution in the long run is to start organizing resistance to all these forms of authoritarianism and bigotry.
That was Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, and activist who's written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Learn more about the link between toxic racist rhetoric and hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Following years of political and economic upheaval, Brazilians went to the polls on October 28th and elected Jair Bolsonaro president, who as a candidate praised his nation's military dictatorship, advocated torture, and frequently made misogynistic, racist, and homophobic remarks. Bolsonaro, who won Brazil's second-round election, 55-45%, over the center-left Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, threatened to destroy, jail, or drive into exile his political opponents. He's also pledged to open up the fragile Amazon rainforest to development and pull Brazil out of the Paris Climate Accords. Bolsonaro's victory comes after conservative political forces in Brazil succeeded in impeaching Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff in 2016 and imprisoning former Workers' Party President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva on dubious corruption charges, who polls indicated would have won the presidency again if he'd been permitted to run. Brazil's lurch to the right with the election of Bolsonaro follows the rise of extreme right-wing politicians across Latin America, Europe, and the United States. Your reporter spoke with Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses grave concerns over the fate of South America's largest nation under Bolsonaro and the political and social movements that have vowed to challenge his authoritarian agenda.
Once Lula was out of the equation, you had no sort of major popular figures in Brazilian politics that could sort of take on Bolsonaro, who did a good job as posing as a complete outsider, as not being corrupt, as someone who would help clean up Brazil in a variety of ways. Very aggressive rhetoric towards his left-wing adversaries that he would jail or force into exile, and even at times has threatened to execute them, labeling others as terrorists and so on. But one further point, which I think really needs to be emphasized, and it's interesting because people like Steve Bannon have actually praised the Bolsonaro campaign on this very point, which is that they were very successful in spreading all sorts of disinformation about Haddad, about the rival candidate from the Workers' Party, through social media, primarily WhatsApp, which is very heavily used in Brazil. Essentially, they had an army of trolls putting out all sorts of fake news in a very, very effective way. They managed to reach millions of Brazilians, and much of what was put out there was taken at face value.
Alex, Bolsonaro is elected to office on a pledge of many repressive and authoritarian programs that he intends to put in place. Tell us about the checks and balances in the Brazilian system, namely the legislative branch. There were elections for the legislative branch as well in the first round of the elections, I believe. And the Workers' Party, as I understand it, will play a prominent role in the Brazilian Congress?
Well, Scott, not necessarily, because while they have more seats than any other party, they are far from having the majority of seats. And in fact, when you look at who won, you know, there's no single party that has a majority. And Bolsonaro's party is actually second. It went from having literally two or three members in the Brazilian parliament to having 52. I think to the Workers' Party, I believe they have around 57 at this point. But you have many, many parties. And actually, when you do the math, you can see that the right has really the strongest coalition in the parliament, or what is assumed will be a future coalition. In terms of the broader checks and balances, including from the judiciary and so on, you know, let's note that the judiciary is extremely, extremely conservative, has shown itself to sort of been playing a partisan role against the Workers' Party in these various corruption investigations. And, you know, there's a good chance that they will soften up to Bolsonaro. And should they not, there's a real threat from the military, I think.
Alex, tell us about the social movements in Brazil that have been very active in pushing progressive policies and working with the former incumbent party, the Workers' Party, in raising the standard of living for millions of Brazilians. How are they likely to react to a Bolsonaro presidency?
Well, they're reacting very badly, and quite understandably. I mean, Bolsonaro just last week labeled some of the major social movements, including the MST, the Landless Workers Movement, and also the MTST, the movement of people without homes, of homeless people, to enormous urban and rural movements that have been very organized and, as you said, have been sort of involved in pushing progressive policies. He's labeled them as terrorists. You know, once you do that, you can, you know, essentially you have carte blanche to really carry out widespread repression and jailings and so on. Already over the last 2 years, certainly the Landless Workers Party has been targeted by the police, targeted by right-wing militias. They've had leaders assassinated. They've had a number of people jailed without justification. So we can expect this to get worse. Interestingly, Bulos, who was a candidate in the first round of the elections for a left-wing party called the PSOL, he is also the leader of the MTST, of the Homeless People's Movement. And he came out with a very strong statement after the election of Bolsonaro, saying, we will not be jailed. We will not be forced out of the country. Again, two things that Bolsonaro said he would do with his left-wing opponents. Instead, Bulos said, we will take to the streets. And I expect we're going to see a very strong organized movement. I fear there could be violent repression of this movement. And I think it's really time for the world to pay more attention to what's going on in Brazil, because things could get bad very quickly.
That was Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Learn more about the current political crisis in Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. October 29th was to be the start date of what's been dubbed the trial of the century, in which 21 youth plaintiffs are suing the U.S. federal government for its failure to protect them from climate change and are demanding a climate protection plan. Instead, the case known as Juliana versus United States was put on hold by the U.S. Supreme Court while it reviews yet another appeal from the Trump administration to throw the case out based on the cost of the trial to the government. It should be noted that the case was initially filed by Our Children's Trust as a civil rights case under the Obama administration, which also tried to block it. An earlier appeal by the Trump administration was denied by the Supreme Court last summer, so plaintiffs are hopeful that this will just be another temporary delay. Rallies were organized across the country
in support of the Children's Trust lawsuit on October 29th, originally planned to coincide with the start of the trial. However, with the case on hold, protests were instead held in support of the youth's ongoing legal battles and to demand that the case be allowed to proceed. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Paul Rink, a third-year student in a joint degree program at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Here, Rink explains why he organized a support rally for the lawsuit in New Haven, Connecticut, and what he hopes will be accomplished in the case.
I wanted to organize the rally because I worked for our Children's Trust over the summer, and I find the work that they're doing in supporting this case really inspirational. I mentioned at the rally that I see climate change as a social justice and a human rights issue, and this case kind of really speaks to that in a very tangible and direct way that I find really motivating.
This lawsuit, Juliana versus United States, was filed in 2015. Can you give us some of the background?
Julia Olson, the lead attorney, has been filing similar litigation for maybe 8 years. And in doing so, she's kind of come up with a really strong legal argument and framework for a case. And that was what led to Juliana versus United States. Kelsey Juliana is a young woman who lives in Eugene, Oregon, and her family, her parents are very involved in the activist community there. And so she immediately latched onto the case when she heard about it. Julia the attorney and Kelsey Juliana the plaintiff, kind of reached out to their networks and found more plaintiffs, and so they have the 21 plaintiffs that are part of the case. In terms of the procedural history of what's happened in the court, the case hasn't even gone to trial yet. What's happened is they filed the claim, and then the government filed some motions that would keep it from going to court. There are a number of motions they can file, and they filed basically everything they could think of to try to keep it from going to the courtroom. And the years in between 2015 and now were kind of all of that happening in terms of the district court hearing what the government had to say about why the case shouldn't go to trial, and then Judge Aiken saying, no, the case should go to trial, and then the government subsequently appealing that decision by Judge Aiken at the circuit level and then the Supreme Court level. So over 3 years, the trial hasn't even begun yet.
The 21 plaintiffs represent a wide diversity of ages, ethnicities, and locations from across the country. The youth were between 9 and 18 years old when the lawsuit was filed, and I've interviewed several of them, and every one has been very well informed and articulate, you know, which just reinforces my belief that it's young people who are taking the lead on the fight to preserve life as we know it on Earth. And, of course, they have the most to lose. I worked with Kelsey Juliana, the lead plaintiff, in a week of action in D.C. back in 2014, after she had participated in the cross-country Great March for Climate Action. And what impressed me, besides her commitment and her intelligence, was her joie de vivre. I remember her singing and dancing around the room as we did our training for nonviolent civil disobedience. Paul Rink, do you know if the intention was to recruit such a diverse group?
I don't believe there was an intention to come up with a certain number. What I do know is they wanted the majority of the plaintiffs to be in Eugene for jurisdictional purposes. The goal was to file the case in the Eugene District Court because they believed they had the best shot of getting a favorable ruling in that particular district. And so I think 11 of the 21 plaintiffs are from Oregon. But then, like you said, there's a lot of geographical spread in terms of the other plaintiffs. And they were recruited either by reaching out to our Children's Trust themselves or by hearing about it through word of mouth and being recruited by Julia.
What will happen if the youth win their lawsuit?
If they were to win, the government would be required to come up with a climate action recovery plan, which is desperately needed. But in a lot of senses, I think the power of this case lies less in whether it wins or loses and much more so in creating this very tangible ethical plea to have a greater spread of the public within the United States and abroad, not only trust that climate change is actually happening, but believe that it's something that needs to be acted upon. I think there's something really visceral about seeing these children stand up to their government for their right to life in the future. It kind of makes a really strong moral narrative that I find very motivating and I think has the potential to tap into a lot of people that maybe beforehand had not considered climate change to be as big of an issue. And even if it doesn't make them change their mind completely about what they're going to do about climate change, maybe it would plant the seed that would create change in the future in their minds and hearts.
That was Paul Rink, an organizer of one of the scores of rallies held across the U.S. on October 29th in support of a youth-led lawsuit against the U.S. government for its failure to take action on climate change. Learn more about the Children's Trust lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on RECFM in Riverton, Maryland, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Against mass incarceration. You wouldn't know it from corporate media, but a struggle is going on across the nation against mass incarceration. Prisoners are waging hunger strikes and other collective actions to give voice to Incarceration Nation, the manifestation of mass incarceration. In Pennsylvania, prisoners at the state's newest joint, the $400 million Phoenix Prison, planned phone and commissary fasts to protest the conditions, but the DOC preempted these actions with a statewide lockdown based on a bogus claim of drug exposures. Using such a pretext, state officials locked down the entire state for 2 weeks and afterwards imposed a draconian mail system that required friends and family of prisoners to mail letters to a screening business in St. Petersburg, Florida. So, despite the silence of the corporate media, prisons remain a place of agitation, of protest, and of resistance. Meanwhile, I thank you all for supporting our efforts in Philadelphia courts as we struggle to open up new appeals. As the late Fred Hampton said, The beat goes on. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Mike Africa Jr. announced to the world the following. Finally free. On August 8, 1978, my dad was taken away from me. On October 23, 2018, I got him back. Free the Move 9. Mike Africa is known as a committed runner. Even while he was in the Philadelphia County Jail, Old Holmesburg, he ran the periphery of the yards like a deer. He is a quiet, serious man who has suffered extraordinary repression during his prison days. What lights him up is his wife, Move member Debbie Africa, and their two children, Whit and Mike. He has also been a serious student of music, playing guitar for many years. Many years ago, when I worked as a reporter for WAJT Radio, I invited Move members to the station to prepare some interviews. Shortly thereafter, four or five Move men arrived at the station. And when I looked out into the parking lot, I was surprised to not see a bus or a station wagon. When I asked the brothers where they had parked, they burst into laughter. When I asked why they were laughing, one brother said, matter-of-factly, that they didn't drive to the station. They ran to the station from Move's old house and headquarters at 33rd and Powelton Avenue. Mike had one thing in mind, asking, "Where's the music at, man?" Even then, this was around 1976, his love of music was evident. Now, free, he can listen to music from around the world. Mike Africa, free. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you. tree of life. Kaddish in Jewish ritual is sung at the graveside of the departed. It is a chant, a song, a psalm of life and loss, which now, in the quiet city of Pittsburgh, must be sung almost a dozen times after a white racist armed with an AK entered a synagogue, a Jewish temple, during a naming ceremony for children and left death in his wake. This massacre occurred just days or hours after another man left over a dozen bombs to be mailed to several former presidents, an actor, and several prominent black politicians. What connects these two events besides time? Both men left messages online showing hatred for immigrants, whom they called invaders. Where have we heard that word recently? At Trump rallies, the U.S. president sends his audiences into wild applause when he damns people of Latin America as invaders of North America. Yes, it must be said that Trump spoke out against anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish hatred recently. But I ask you, if you can, to listen again, you will hear silence, no applause, no yells or peals of agreement, just silence of the lambs. President Trump began his campaign by damning Mexicans and flashed from there to immigrants. And after his embrace of the white nationalists of Charlottesville, Virginia, who can be surprised at the flash fire of hatred for Jews? Trump has lit the flames of rhetoric with his tongue at rallies across the nation. How can we be surprised when those who hear him send bombs or open fire? From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is there a realistic prospect of election rigging in the 2018 midterm elections? What lessons were learned from the 2016 elections that could help preserve the integrity of the November 6th vote? Are there any substantive changes in the renegotiated NAFTA agreement, or was it merely a cynical campaign ploy in the run-up to the midterms? What does the USMCA agreement have to do with China? Will the Democrats take the House on November 6th? On this week's Global Research NewsHour radio show, we take an early look at the upcoming midterm elections and examine the factors that will likely influence the outcome. First, we hear from Bob Vitrakis, lawyer, author, and election integrity expert, about the possibility of foul play in the November 6th vote. In our second half hour, we hear from political economist, writer, and commentator Jack Rasmus about what's in the newly renegotiated NAFTA agreement and how that legislation may play out in the congressional elections. On this week's program, Breaking the Blue Wave, Rigged U.S. Elections and the New NAFTA. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 2nd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This year's Asian Parliamentary Assembly, or APA, just took place in the southwestern Pakistani port city of Gwadar, the terminal point of the Silk Road's flagship project of CPEC, as well as its mainland maritime pivot, which importantly allowed Islamabad to show off the progress that's been made thus far on this game-changing initiative. Around 100 parliamentarians from 26 countries such as Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia arrived to participate in the event, which was the first high-profile multilateral one of this level to take place there. The author suggested back in spring 2017 during a speech at Pakistan's National Defense University that the country prioritizing hosting large-scale events in this growing connectivity nexus in order to promote CPEC, proposing at the time that a brand new function one day be unveiled provisionally called the Gwadar Gathering for bringing together a wide array of academic, political, military, business, and civil society figures. The two-day APA meeting can therefore be seen as an organizational and logistical precursor for preparing Gwadar to host even larger functions in the future, such as the unique one that the author suggested. It's also relevant in and of itself, not only for the work that the organization carried out during this time, but because of the soft power goals that Pakistan advanced as well. That comes from the article, The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC. The Asian Parliamentary Assembly meeting in Gwadar was good news for CPEC by Andrew Korybko, posted October 31st, originally appearing at Eurasia Future. Through its mapping and labeling, the Hamle report explains, quote, "One can deduce that Google Maps recognizes the existence of Israel with Jerusalem as its capital, but not Palestine," unquote. There are further aspects of the way Google has wiped Palestinian life off the map, though. As the Hamle report maps in some detail, Palestinian villages in the Naqab, in the Negev desert, deemed unrecognized by Israel inside of what is sometimes termed Israel proper, the territories of Palestine occupied in 1948, are not properly mapped by Google. These villages are only visible in Google Maps when zooming in very closely, the report explains, but otherwise appear to be non-existent. This means that when looking at Google Maps, these villages appear to be not there. That comes from the article, How Google Wipes Palestine Off the Map, by Asa Winstanley, posted October 31st, originally appearing at Middle East Monitor. Bowers was evidently motivated by a combination of rabid anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant chauvinism. He posted comments on social media just prior to the attack, linking his hatred of Jews to the efforts of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, or HIAS, with which the Tree of Life Synagogue is affiliated to assist refugees fleeing Central America. Quote, HIAS likes to bring invaders in that kill our people, he wrote. I can't sit by and watch my people get slaughtered. The language he employed, including the use of invaders to refer to migrants fleeing poverty and violence in Central America caused by U.S. imperialism, is that of the Trump administration. That comes from the article, Mass Shooting at Pittsburgh Synagogue, Anti-Semitic Violence Erupts in America, by Joseph Kishore, posted October 31st, originally appearing at World Socialist website. Thus, at the table with Italy and Russia was seated the stone guest, the privileged ally closely followed by Italy. So nothing was said about the fact that on the 25th of October, the day after Prime Minister Conte in Moscow had qualified the state of bilateral relations between Italy and Russia as excellent, Italian armed forces began the war game Trident Justice 2018 with other NATO forces under U.S. command and directed against Russia. This is an exercise in which the U.S. and NATO bases in Italy play a major part. There was no mention either of the fact that on the 25th of October, the day after Prime Minister Conte in Moscow had qualified Russia as a strategic partner, his government in Brussels participated in the North Atlantic Council, which, on the basis of information supplied by the USA, unanimously accused Russia of violating the INF Treaty with behavior destabilizing for our security. The Conte government thus supported de facto the U.S. plan to abandon the INF Treaty and once again to deploy in Europe, including Italy, medium-range nuclear missiles pointed at Russia. That was from an article under the headline, Video, The Stone Guest at the Table with Italy and Russia, by Manlio Di Nucci, posted October 31st, originally published in Italian on Il Manifesto. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Americans are back at the polls on Tuesday, November 6th. For the all-important election of candidates for the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, as well as elections of governors at the state level. These elections take place at the midpoint of an elected president's term in office. The midterm elections are typically seen as a referendum on a sitting president's performance in office. According to Wikipedia, over the course of the past 21 midterm elections, the party of the president has lost an average of 30 seats in the House and 4 seats in the Senate. Author Philip Giraldi notes in his article for Strategic Culture Foundation that the 2018 midterm elections are being hailed as perhaps the most important national election since those of 1968, which elected Richard Milhouse Nixon to power, and of 1980, which resulted in Ronald Reagan replacing one-term incumbent Jimmy Carter. Some of the issues potentially impacting voter choices include the partisan dust-up over Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, job opportunities in the wake of President Trump's protectionist policies, and the treatment of migrants to the United States, including the several thousand children, parents, elderly, and other adults from Central American countries now headed for the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Of course, Trump himself has proven to be one of the most controversial and polarizing presidents in recent American history, with his unstatesmanlike tweets and his relaying of demonstrably false facts as truth. Democrats, unwilling to confront their own failures to connect with the electorate, have accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of interfering with the U.S. elections. The campaign has been punctuated with a number of violent incidents, including pipe bombs being sent exclusively to prominent Democrats, including former DNC chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, California Representative Maxine Waters, Hillary Clinton, and former President Barack Obama. There's also the recent mass shooting in a Pittsburgh synagogue, which claimed the lives of 11 people. Many have commented on how the perpetrator, like many white nationalists, have been emboldened by Trump's public statements. In total, Trump backers and detractors alike may be motivated to head for the polls in higher than average numbers to sound off on the issues gripping America in 2018. The political news and polling data aggregator Real Clear Politics is predicting that based on current trends, the Democrats will retake the House of Representatives, winning 203 seats to the Republicans' 196. It should be noted, however, that the same firm predicted a Hillary Clinton win in the 2016 presidential elections. As the Global Research NewsHour previously documented at the time, we know that partisan players do have the ability to distort voter intentions by both denying the vote to key constituencies and by tampering with voting machines through the use of backdoor channels. Bob Fitrakis is one of the election integrity experts who has researched these methods of vote tampering. He's an American lawyer, political author, and writer, a political candidate, and professor of political science in the Social and Behavioral Sciences Department at Columbus State Community College. He's been the editor of the Columbus Free Press since 1993 and has written extensively about the U.S. presidential election of 2004 and the related 2004 U.S. election voting controversies. He detailed his observations about the 2016 general election 2 years ago and joins us again with his concerns about the upcoming midterms. Thank you for joining us, Bob Fitrakis.
Oh, glad to be on.
Maybe you could once again bring our listeners up to speed about what you mean by the stripping and flipping of the vote that you exposed in past elections.
Well, the stripping really is the purging or deleting of names of voters from the voting rolls. Flip is, of course, once you strip enough voters, it's fairly easy to program a computer to get the results that you want, particularly when the United States votes on machines with software programmed often by partisan for-profit corporate entities who are protected by laws that their programming is proprietary. It's secret.
Okay. And is it not true that Republicans are typically the beneficiaries of these mechanisms?
Well, the Republicans historically, a lot of this emerged really around the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. And a lot of these techniques were really used in the Third World, were done covertly, so-called benign operations, where instead of bloody coups, you just rigged, local elections, as you did in the late 40s in Italy, or, they tried to do with the mainframe for Marcos in the Philippines or over Aquino. So there's been a long history of this, and the Republicans have overwhelmingly been the beneficiaries. It seems like the companies tend to lean that way politically, and some of them have gone out of business. Depot, when Walden O'Dell notoriously promised to deliver Ohio's electoral votes in 2004, and he had been a support member of the Bush, George W. Bush reelection team.
Election polls going into the current midterms have been registering anywhere from 3 to 11 percentage point leads for the Democrats. Factoring in the rigging methods that you've mentioned, how would you be inclined to adjust those figures?
Well, I used to think it was in the 5 to 6 vote range. But there's been numerous examples. Max Cleland down in Georgia, where they've shifted double digits. And the thing to remember is that if you shift 5 points from one candidate to the other, that's a 10-point shift. So I think their comfort margin, is about 10 points. But I've seen races where it's gone as high as 13.
Have you seen any early signs that the fix may be in for the Republicans this time around?
Well, it's widely reported, including mainstream newspapers like the Houston Chronicle and numerous other newspapers, and it was admitted by election officials in Texas that there was clearly a problem with the programming in Texas. People that were trying to vote a straight party Democratic ticket were able to do that, all except the Senate race, where Cruz would show up, the Republican candidate, Ted Cruz would show up as a Democrat on a straight party vote. So numerous reports of that documented and accepted.
Hmm. Are there any other key races that you're watching currently?
Well, I'm here in Central Ohio. I'm watching the 12th district race that was incredibly close. The question of stripping voters there, one of the targets they use are college students. And there's been, thousands of new students in the 12th district at Ohio State University who have been signed up. The problem in many cases there is you show up to vote and there's no record, or they claim you have to vote provisionally, and often those ballots aren't counted. Usually from some minor reason, you know, you signed on the outside envelope below the line, you used a initial on the ballot but didn't put an initial on the outside envelope, you left off a zip code on either on the outside or the inside. So there's a real long history of voter suppression of college students in Ohio. Hmm.
I know another constituency that's typically been disenfranchised have been black and minority voters who typically vote Democrat. Any specific areas that you've noticed where that situation has gotten worse, perhaps?
Well, the Democratic Party actually caught a break at the Sixth Circuit Court. The Secretary of State, which, not surprisingly, he's running as Lieutenant Governor John Houston in Ohio, won a case at the Supreme Court where he argued he could remove voters after not voting in two federal elections, which, as you know, in 1 year you can have two federal elections, as we have in the 12th district. There's a, the primary election, and then there was a special election. Although even though these people had voted last year in a local election, he sends them a mailing that looks like junk mail. And if they don't respond, he could remove them from the voting rolls. And the Supreme Court of the United States, by a 5-4 vote, allowed that. But the Sixth Circuit, just within the past few days, a 3-judge panel voted 2-1. That they weren't properly notified that, sending stuff that looks like designed like junk mail with a card buried in a variety of papers was not sufficient notice. So they just reinstated, hundreds of thousands of voters since 2011 that were illegally purged. And here's the thing people ought to think about. I mean, Ohio and most states are ID states. Why would you remove anyone from the voting roll unless, they had died or moved out of state? Why would you remove anyone in a state that requires you to show ID proving you live at that address? It's never really made any sense to strip basic fundamental rights, particularly from the poor minority and particularly the black community that has been massively, massively targeted in Ohio since the 2000 election.
Well, what is the official justification? Is there one?
Well, they're arguing that, they have to keep the polls up to date. That used to be a mandate of two election cycles, that being an 8-year period. Then they switched it down to a 6-year period. Then they switched it down to two elections and, ineffective as the court held in the Sixth Circuit, notification. So they've never really been able to explain it other than they can get away with it at the Supreme Court of the United States, which, you know, has shifted in a very partisan direction to anything the Republican Party wants since the 2000 Bush v. Gore decision.
Why has the Russiagate meme come to dominate current political discourse around election tampering and not the more substantial methods that you and other election integrity researchers have documented?
Well, I think, you know, when you're looking for a new Cold War, and there was some evidence that the Russians, you know, went into some voter registration areas and no real evidence that they flipped any elections, I think it's easier, you know, to worry about some outside power as opposed to deal with the fundamental problem of non-transparency and the fact that you've got private contractors literally with the keys to the kingdom, people that are secretly, you know, programming computers, often here in Franklin County use 2.3 million lines of code when most programmers, you know, said you could use open source code and need about 1,500 lines to simply count prime plus one, right? I mean, a lot of these programs subtract votes. Increasingly, you know, we found that many of them, ES&S machines, for example, that have cellular hookups, so you can actually dial into, you know, quote, fixed problems. But that also allows you to fix the election. So I think it's just easier to kind of approach the problem by blaming it on an outside foreign nation as opposed to admit that we've had a non-democratic, non-transparent system since, you know, at least 2000, in that election in Florida in 2000 where they subtracted 4,000 votes for Gore and ES&S added 16,000 for Bush. That 20,000 vote swing was the only reason that election was called by Fox News, which, by the way, used John Ellis, the first cousin of George W. Bush, on a 30-day contract to claim that Bush had won when it was really based on a supposed computer glitch. Hmm.
There has been considerable attention to the integrity of elections since the 2016 election, certainly. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on some significant innovations since then, which have either alleviated or possibly made things worse in terms of disenfranchising the electorate?
Well, yeah, you've got the Supreme Court decision that makes it much easier to purge voters. And again, the voters being purged are overwhelmingly minority, disproportionately minority voters in the poor, the core base of the Democratic Party. But you've also have certain people. The one that surprised me was a former CIA director, James Woolsey, who co-wrote an editorial in the New York Times essentially saying we need to go to open source and there needs to be a ballot in every machine. There's also been a push towards the use of digital scanners, which have really developed out of kind of German banking technology where you scan every ballot. You have a ballot image and you have audit logs so you can actually check and make sure that the ballots match what the computer digitized machine is counting. Now, the problem there we've had in Ohio, and I've brought two lawsuits on it, is that in Ohio, they've won the right to turn their security features off. So you buy the state-of-the-art equipment. 14 counties have it, these ES&S 850s, you know, these county central tabulators. So you think, well, this will be a little more transparent. And then they decide they're going to turn that feature off and use it for write-in votes. So the machines were designed – to be, you know, more friendly if there's any adjudication or any questions, and then essentially you turn them off. It's like buying a house and buying a state-of-the-art security system and then making sure it's turned off.
Bob Vitrakis, how responsibly has the media in the U.S. reported on the observations that you have documented?
Well, it's good to report that 14 years after the fact, the New York Times actually did a New York Times Magazine cover story, and they actually, for them, crossed the Rubicon and reported on stuff that was public fact in lawsuits reported by the alternative media since 2004. They actually reported that the machines were indeed flipping in Mahoning County, where the city of Youngstown is. And really, they had never touched that story when it was well known and well documented, not even denied by the election officials. So 14 years after the fact, we now know that the votes were flipping from John Kerry to George W. Bush. And often when they do report it, though, some of the media that reported mainstream will say something like, well, there's calibration problems. Yeah. They're not saying, you know, the votes are flipping. Your vote's going to the wrong person. They'll say, well, there's some problem with the computer voting machine configuration. That means the votes are going to the wrong person. So they have a tendency, even when they cover it, you know, to not go into any great detail and challenge the legitimacy of a system that does not meet basic criteria for democracy.
And finally, Bob, could you maybe let our listeners know how you anticipate that Democrats and the media at large are likely to respond if we see the same disparity between the polls and the actual election results that we saw in 2016?
Well, I've really have no faith that the candidates are willing to challenge when it appears to be open theft. Remember, in the 2016 campaign, had the results come in, you know, 13 states showed improbable results when compared to the exit polls, which would have been a red flag for the United States State Department had it been a nation state. Had these elections occurred outside the United States, our State Department and USAID would not have verified them because the results were too improbable. And 12 of those states went to Donald Trump. You know, there were three or more standard deviations outside the predicted results, meaning that in 99 cases out of 100, we could say with 95% certainty, those weren't the correct results. And many of them were well beyond the 99 out of 100. You know, they were 1 in 1,000, 1 in 15,000. But the Democratic candidates have been taught or coached not to really challenge those results. They don't want to be perceived as sore losers. But, you know, I think voters should take, you know, yellow tape to the poll and, you know, police tape and or some yellow ribbons. And whenever a machine flips in front of you, you should, you know, put out police tape and demand that they come in and, you know, examine the machine and take it out of circulation.
I'd love to see that. If you get a chance, you maybe can snap some pictures for us and send them our way.
Yeah, it should be treated like the crime zone that it is.
Bob Vitrakis, I wish to thank you for your time and for sharing your perspectives with our listening audience.
All right. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Bob Vitrakis, lawyer, author, and editor of the Columbus Free Press. He joined us from Columbus, Ohio. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. It's widely believed that one of the big issues in the 2016 election and a critical determinant for Trump was the promise to scrap NAFTA. Well, NAFTA has theoretically been replaced with something called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. The leaders of all three NAFTA countries have claimed the new agreement is an improvement over the previous nearly 25-year-old free trade agreement. The reported removal of investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms and the insistence on increased North American content in autos traded under the deal are hailed as gains. But do these benefits constitute smoke and mirrors? And what about the negative aspects of the deal? Could labor and the environment be worse off? Joining us to discuss the fine print of the deal is Jack Rasmus. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He hosts the show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. He blogs at jackrasmus.com and is the author of a number of articles and books, including Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, and the forthcoming The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump. The Global Research News Hour first asked Dr. Rasmus to provide our audience with his overall take on the USMCA.
Well, the main thing your audience should know is that this is a token change. And I've been arguing since last March when Trump initiated his trade offensive with tariffs on steel and aluminum that this is a phony trade war, at least with U.S. allies. It's not a phony trade war with China. China's the real target, but all the rest of this is really about November politics in the U.S. It's about economic nationalist appeals and America First politics and Trump attempting to ensure that in the November midterm U.S. elections, he retains control of Congress, particularly the U.S. House. It's very important for him to do so, and he's been politicking, giving speeches none end. And, you know, in 2016, this economic nationalism worked for him, and he's resurrected it again, or never gave it up. And he's using this theme. And the trade negotiations are really a part of all this politicking, November election. You know, he said he's going to tear up NAFTA, right? Well, you know, he crossed out the name and he scribbled in a few changes and additions. That's really what we got here when you look at it. South Korea was the template earlier this year of a softball deal with South Korea. South Korea is one of the biggest, I think the second or third largest steel importer to the U.S., and they totally got off the hook. And what we got out of South Korea was some token quotas on autos and not on trucks, you see. South Korea and U.S. can sell trucks, and all the growth in autos in the U.S. Are really in trucks, you see, small trucks, light trucks. And the auto industry itself is now in retreat, slowing down. So even the quotas on autos, no quotas on trucks, are just on paper. And that's going to be the case with the Canada-Mexico-U.S. deal. As well, one of the provisions in the Canada-U.S. deal is that Canada cannot import more than 2.6 million cars to the U.S. It imports 2 million now, so that's a pretty big cushion there, 2.6 million, particularly when the auto industry sales are beginning to weaken in all of North America and everywhere. And there's no quotas on trucks, you know, so it's on paper. It's a token deal. And, of course, we still have the aluminum and steel tariffs. They're not resolved yet, but they will be. They don't go into effect till October 25th, and Trump has said we'll resolve those, sometime in November at the latest. The deal is not really closed. You know, there are a lot of open ends to it. A number of sections in the Canada-U.S. deal have not been resolved. So is there a deal? Why did they announce there was a deal? Well, again, because Trump needs something before the November elections. And also it makes Trudeau look good that, you know, he forced the U.S. to an agreement and he'll emphasize the areas that he wants to emphasize. And in Mexico, they were rushing to get a deal before AMLO, the new president, comes in. So politics all around are playing a bigger role, I think, in this deal than truly economics. And we can look at in more detail about the deal with Canada and Mexico. But when you look at it, it's a pretty softball deal in a number of areas. It certainly isn't tearing everything up. And, of course, American business sighed with relief that it isn't tearing this thing up, because there's a lot at stake for them as well as business in Canada and Mexico. And then, of course, when you talk about business in Canada, business in Mexico, a lot of this is American companies, right? It's not really Mexican companies. Yeah. It's American companies. So one of the provisions in the Canada-Mexico deal is intellectual property, right? Well, what do they mean by that? Well, a lot of what they mean by intellectual property is big pharma. The U.S. wants to be able to force Canada and Mexico pharmaceutical companies, which are largely American companies located there, to charge high comparable prices in Canada and Mexico, just as they do in the U.S., well, then the price gouge. And that was part of the deal as well. The dispute mechanism remains in place, except for one small provision there that businesses can't sue their governments, you see. Canadian businesses can't sue the U.S. government, and vice versa, U.S. business, Canadian government, and same with Mexico. But the dispute mechanism pretty much remains the same, and Trudeau is going to make a big deal about that. See, I won on that one.
Well, that is one of the major points that's being raised by progressives on both sides of the border, that the Chapter 11 provision is been eliminated from this new deal. And, of course, that we've had 58 of these sorts of trade disputes between Canada and the United States, the lion's share affecting the Canadian policy.
It's not been eliminated. It's just not changed, you see. It's there. It's in the side agreement. They got to tidy it up a little bit. But all that's changed is you can't sue the governments, you see. But it's there. It's not that it's been eliminated at all. And that's a minor deal, a minor change in the whole dispute mechanism, and a win for Canada, right? That demand was always a stalking horse by U.S. negotiators. You know, they never really were going to go to the mat on that particular element of the deal.
Some of the points that are raised as positives, the idea that there's an insistence for that auto parts that they be that there's more sourcing for North America, like it's up to 75% made in North America, and also the idea that it's they're insisting that in certain circumstances the benefits will require or mandate that you raise the wage up to $16 an hour for a percentage of some of the parts being traded. So I'm wondering if you could comment on these supposed gains.
When they say you raise the content, North American content, from 62.5 to 75%, really that's aimed at China, because Mexico was beginning to contract parts from Asia, from China, instead of making them in Mexico. So that restriction, which is really kind of minimal, 62 to 75, is really aimed at China. That's a provision aimed at China. You know, 62 to 75 is not much. Raising the Mexican wages to $16 an hour on 30% of auto workers, by when? Right? How long is it going to take for them to raise it to $16? They're not going to do it overnight. Well, they don't say. And only 30% of the auto parts? Well, that's really tokenism, right? That's to get the labor vote, to get the support of AFL-CIO in the United States, you see? The provision that's not talked about enough, I think, also targeting China, is the U.S. insistence and the agreement of Canada and Mexico that they will not negotiate a free trade deal with Mexico. And if they do, the U.S. can pull out immediately out of the USMCA deal, right? Well, that's kind of an infringement on the sovereignty of Canada, right? And Mexico, you know, you should be able to negotiate trade deals whoever you want. But in the case of the new NAFTA 2.0, if Canada does that, well, then they're going to scrap the whole thing again, right? U.S. is determining Canadian sovereignty in this particular case, right? So that should be talked about more, because as soon as this thing is wrapped up after the November elections here in the U.S., the big attack is on with China, and it's already well on its way with $250 billion in tariffs on China, and that fight's just beginning. I've been writing about that too.
Yeah, more on the sovereignty question. I know that one of the things that people are mentioning, at least on this side of the border, is the impact on dairy and being able to control, allowing the market to be flooded with dairy products from the U.S., where in Canada we do have certain restrictions on bovine growth hormone, whereas they don't have those things in the United States. So, I mean, that's one major impact coming out of this. And so, and also with regard to the, sovereignty, what we've heard is that Canada is going to be, or I guess any of the NAFTA partners, I mean, according to one of the provisions, the NME clause, I think it's chapter, clause 32.10, it reads, quote, "Entry by any party into a free trade agreement with a non-market country shall allow the other parties to terminate this agreement on six-month notice and replace this agreement with an agreement between them." So basically that, as I understand it, the concern is that if Canada wanted to have a free trade agreement with China, as apparently they do, this agreement is using as an obstacle to that. So, yeah, again, this is all perhaps further undermining the sovereignty of the NAFTA partners, particularly Canada and Mexico.
Well, commenting on your reference to the dairy provisions here, 3.5% more access of U.S. to Canadian dairy market. But if you look at it, we're not talking about milk here. Right, we're not talking about selling milk into Canada. What we're talking about is powdered milk and formula milk, right? And that refers to what you were talking about, Canadian limitations on, the purity of that kind of stuff in the U.S. not really having controls over that, letting these companies that produce powdered and formula milk to fill it full of who knows what's in that stuff, right? That's really what the 3.5% is, to allow American companies to sell more powdered and formula into Canada, concentrate and so forth, right? That's really helping certain companies, chemical companies in the U.S., not really taking over sales of, typical average milk.
On the NME clause, this idea that, what we heard from, there was an American lawmaker who indicated that they instigated this clause in response to concerns they had about Trudeau wanting to sign a trade agreement with China. What does this agreement mean in the context of the trade war with China that you referenced? What is it going to do for, not just Canada and Mexico, but potentially other countries, perhaps those in the new TPP agreement or Europe? Is there an impact there?
Well, we have yet to see what impact that'll have on TPP. When TPP was scuttled in U.S. by Congress, not by Trump, by the way. What happened was Japan took over the lead for the U.S. And Japan is the surrogate lead negotiator for the U.S. And at some point, the U.S. probably, in my view, will rejoin it, rejoin the TPP, but only after you know, the China situation is trade situation is resolved. But it certainly will have some impact on the TPP existing partners and how they look at upcoming negotiations. You know, at some point, the U.S. will renegotiate, Trump will, with Japan. But Japan will fall in line with whatever the template is here. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the template with South Korea and now NAFTA. The same with Europe. Trump started going after Europe, but then he totally suspended all of that with Europe with a deal to focus on NAFTA. As far as China is concerned, it's a different animal as far as trade is concerned. Look, there are three U.S. trading team factions in the U.S. with regard to trade to China. I've said this and wrote about this on my blog, jackrasmus.com. And they are as follows. One, you have the bankers and U.S. multinational corporations who want a bigger share of ownership of their operations in China. Up to now, it was 49%. They couldn't own more. China has conceded already, has given the okay for 51% and has indicated, well, you can even own 100% maybe. So the big bankers love that because they'll finance the deals for the expansion, and the big banks are being given an opening to expand in China. That's why Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary of the United States and ex-Goldman Sachs investment bank CEO, who's led the U.S. negotiating team with China, was quite happy with the deal last May. He thought he had a deal, and he came back to the United States, and Trump scuttled it. The other second element is China has indicated that it will buy $100 billion more a year in U.S. agricultural products. That was the second faction on the U.S. team. So the Chinese have made big concessions to two of the three factions. What's the third faction? It's the U.S. Pentagon and industrial military-industrial complex and their friends in Congress. They're the ones that are holding back the deal with China and are pushing a hard line that now has Trump's ear, because Trump loves the military, you know, draft dodger Trump loves whatever, you know. It's kind of like workers who were union stewards or something to become supervisors. They tend to be harder on their own people that they came from than managers, you know, who didn't come from the ranks. And there's a little bit of that psychological phenomenon here with Trump. You know, Trump, the draft dodger, now loves the military, right? But that group, that third faction, the fight with China is really over next generation technologies. I'm talking about 5G, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. These are the industries of the future. They are also the military technology of the future. And the U.S. is worried that China may just leapfrog the U.S. militarily in certain areas, and they want to stop it. They've put you know, the kibosh on China buying tech companies or buying companies in the U.S. They've even come up with this ridiculous thing that somehow China got its chips into the servers of this company, Micron, Super Micron, and they're spying on all the U.S. companies and the U.S. government in the U.S., although there's absolutely no evidence to that effect. Reminds me of the yellow cake scam back before Iraq, right? But it's technology. It's about technology. And they want to stop China's technology development, what it calls its 2025 program, where they want to be at par with the U.S. in military technology in those three areas by 2025. Well, that's what's behind putting the kibosh on a deal with China, which they almost had in May, you see. Mnuchin comes back you know, and says, hey, we got a good deal. We get 51 or 100% ownership, and you're going to buy $100 billion more. But all of a sudden it gets turned around in Congress, congressional friends of the Pentagon, and gets stopped. And we're going to see after the November elections whether that's going to really escalate into something even more serious, not only on the trade front, but maybe a new Cold War with China. Remains to be seen, but that's going to be the topic of 2019. And, of course, as far as trade negotiations with Europe are concerned, the U.S. can't do anything until we see what happens with Brexit in next March. So everything there is on hold for that. But that will look a lot like NAFTA, I believe, some token tweaking. But the China trade war is real. That's why you see this provision, Chapter 3210, in the NAFTA 2.0 agreement, which says you go and negotiate a deal with China, it's all over. As far as our deal is concerned, we're going to be back to square one. By the way, the NAFTA deal does not take effect until 2020, right? And it has to be approved by the legislatures. And who knows what's going to happen? I've been predicting we're going to have a significant recession in the U.S. in late 2019. And that could upend the whole thing. Or politically, it's not likely, but the Democrats may push this impeachment thing, although I don't believe that's real on their part. And
that kind of brings us to the next question. Yeah. I wanted to bring up, which is the impact on the upcoming congressional elect, the midterm elections. I think there's a sense out there that with the Kavanaugh hearings and a lot of the other negative press that Mr. Trump has been getting lately, that this could lead to some sort of a surge for the Democrats. But you have a very different take on that. And so I'm hoping that we could maybe tease your thoughts out, maybe a prediction as we get closer to that date.
Well, I'm very skeptical of these polls and all this hoopla about a blue wave, right? These are the same polls that in 2016 said Trump would only get 15% of the vote and the Democrats would sweep everything. These are the same pollsters. It serves the Democratic Party to really spin it that there's a blue wave. Now, certainly the Democrats will win some houses, some seats in the U.S. House, but they can't just win some seats. They have to really sweep it to have any change. And even if they sweep it, my view is that they'll talk the talk here about impeachment, but they won't walk it. They'll use the impeachment in committee meetings. They won't bring it to the floor of the House, and they'll use that as a battering ram for the 2020 elections. I don't think the Democrats are serious about impeachment, but we'll see. In either way, whatever comes in the November elections, midterm elections, I have a sense that it's going to be a kind of a consciousness bombshell that was similar to 2016 when Trump won. Maybe not as strong, but significant, because if the Democrats don't win, what happens to this blue wave? And you're going to see a lot of liberals and Democrats and progressives going to get very discouraged with the Democrats, and rightfully so. And they won't turn out in 2020. If the Democrats don't have a blue wave, then it's really going to start sinking in that the Democratic Party is inept and tactically bankrupt. You can see the moves they made this year, tactically bankrupt, from the Dreamers thing back February, where they said a line in the sand, we're not going to allow a passing of the budget here unless you have the Dreamers bill, and then they totally backed off of that. And then the Kavanaugh hearings, a lot of huffing and puffing. And the latest I just heard was that the Democrats have given up on about 20 federal judgeship appointees here in the last couple of days in order for them to get out of Washington and campaign. They're just throwing in the towel everywhere. And I think if they don't really sweep November, people are going to have a consciousness awakening here that these folks are unable to deliver. And, of course, that's not true for just now. That's been happening for years. The Democrats have become just a coastal party. Their whole apparatus has collapsed, except on the coasts, and except in certain little islands, the big cities, throughout most of the country. And that's a big change. People don't realize how much that's a big change. They spend more time fighting Bernie Sanders and his supporters than they really do Trump. There's a lot of talk. What have they really been able to deliver? Not very much.
The Democratic Party was the party that established under Bill Clinton that saying, it's the economy, stupid. And it doesn't seem really like that's been their focus, whereas the Republicans, at least they're addressing it rhetorically. But whether or not that actually pays off, it's kind of hard to see that visible. So I think you have those sorts of forces competing for potential.
Yes, and if you look at the Democratic Party, this isn't the Democratic Party of my father and grandfather. You know, I mean, this is the party that changed dramatically under Bill Clinton. The Democratic Leadership Conference took over. And this is a party in which over 100 members of its national committee are corporate lobbyists and CEOs. And that's why they don't really seriously push economic issues anymore. I mean, they're not even for Medicare for All. Now they say they are, but they, you know, we're against it. Medicare for All, which they originated in the 60s. And they're all for identity politics. You see, identity politics, I think, is a big conspiracy to avoid talking about the real economic issues, you know, of wages, of pensions and benefits and jobs and all these other real issues that the Republicans are leveraging. They're not going to do anything about it, but they're leveraging that discontent. Trump was very good at that. And the Democrats are, you know, pushing identity politics. Unless you talk about Bernie Sanders, who comes in and tries to talk about traditional Democrat issues. They squashed him. And their recent Democrat National Committee convention, they retained the superdelegates, you know, only on the first vote of a candidate would the superdelegates not vote. But nonetheless, the chair of the Democratic Party can veto any candidate who runs on a Democratic ticket. They're going to make sure that there's no more real Bernie Sanders, that there's no more real resurrection of the Democratic Party. My radio show, Alternative Visions, on a progressive radio network, we're going to have a show next week where we're having Nick Brana on. Nick was very active as a liaison between the Sanders organization and the Democratic Party. He saw inside. He used to work for the Democratic Party, and he saw inside what was really going on. And, you know, it was his observation. How do you change a party where over 100 members of its DNC, National Committee, are lobbyists? You can't. Oh, so if you can't have Rishi, and you talk about identity politics, you see. And identity politics are the bane of progressive politics in America, I believe. It's a big distraction, and it opens up the whole working class to be absorbed by the Republicans, which they're doing a very good job on right now.
We just heard an interview with blogger and commentator Dr. Jack Rasmus, author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, by Clarity Press. He hosts the weekly radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network and blogs at jackrasmus.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Technical assistance provided this week by Paul Graham. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.